Judiciary Committee to order. June 9th, 2:05. I'm not going to have Heidi review the two bills. We've done this about three or four times in different processes, at least. I think everybody almost knows it by heart. We have some leftover people that didn't get to testify yesterday, and I'm going to go ahead and have Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and Stephen Briggs come up first so they can be free to do what they need to do, please.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate and House Committees on Judiciary. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and with me is Stephen Briggs, who is the Chief Counsel of our Criminal Justice Division. Our Criminal Justice Division has completed one round of section-by-section review of both the measures that form the package, and that a similar review is being completed by the Criminal Law Unit of our Appellate Division. We have, based on our review, one recommended amendment today that Mr. Briggs will be discussing in a few moments, and if our further review identifies any further specific proposed changes based on concerns, I'll promptly communicate those to the committee and its staff for your, the committees and your staff for your consideration. But at this point, however, I want to offer my very strong support for the amended measures overall, and to extend very special thanks to the legislative work group that I know spent an immense amount of time developing these amended measures. And I think taken together, they represent a significant step forward in our collective effort to reduce the plague of methamphetamine. I was not a member of the governor's meth task force, which was part of the governor's comprehensive public safety review. I instead chaired the adult sentencing committee in that review process, but I was a member of the steering committee of the system review, to which all work of the individual task forces and committees was submitted for consideration as to whether they should be advanced as recommendations to the governor. And the recommendations of the meth task force, which I believe underlie a number of the provisions of these two bills, won broad support, certainly including mine and the steering committee. And I think all the steering committee members were impressed by the thoughtful and comprehensive nature of the task force's recommendations. And then separately, I want to note very quickly that the Conference of Western Attorneys General, or CWAG, in the summer of 2004 made methamphetamine one of its priority issues, and it adopted two basic positions. One is that each state's response should be comprehensive, recognizing the many different facets of this problem, this issue, and secondly, that the single most important action of our states is effective precursor control. That was the first and highest priority that the CWAG assigned to efforts with regard to this issue. I certainly want to congratulate the Assembly for working to approach the meth challenge comprehensively. And then as to precursor control, this is an area in which the legislature and the governor have already made great strides. I think we can rightly view Oregon as a leader state. And at this time, I think the single most important step the Assembly can take is to extend the control structure to liquid and gel forms of products containing pseudoephedrine in light of the recent evidence of the Drug Enforcement Administration that pseudoephedrine is readily extractable from such forms of products. I'm not going to go over the measures in detail, of course, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, but I want to highlight, before turning to Mr. Briggs, the one part of 907-3 that's unique to the Department of Justice, and I think certainly important to the success of the overall assault on methamphetamine. Sections 9, 10, and 11 of 907-3 authorize the Attorney General to hire two attorneys and one other person to work with the state police in investigating and prosecuting cases involving methamphetamine. And we think there are certain important gains from these sections if the Assembly ultimately approves them. First, we know that major meth organizations conduct their enterprises across county boundaries. District attorneys, of course, will continue to have primary jurisdiction to prosecute such cases. Nothing in the bill disturbs that, but in some instances, district attorneys may lack the resources to prosecute a complex multi-county organization. And we think that these new positions which we would assign to our organized crime section, would expand on the existing partnerships we have long established with our district attorneys. And secondly, long experience with task forces has taught us that close integration between the prosecution and investigative functions, specifically between prosecutors and criminal investigators, is an essential ingredient for success. And integrated teams of this character are likely to be much more effective than organizations in which the prosecutor's engagement begins only after the investigation ends. And we would expect these positions, if the Assembly approves them, would enhance the effectiveness of the officers assigned to the Oregon State Police for the Oregon State Police Methamphetamine Task Force. At this point, I'd like to ask Mr. Briggs if he would review for the committees the specific concern arising from the immunity provisions of the bill and discuss our recommended cure of the problem, if you will.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krager, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Just very briefly, referring to House Bill 2485, Section 7, that section purports to provide immunity for a person who reports a possession of a precursor substance or a transaction involving a precursor substance. And as we reviewed that section, it appeared to us that it may be overly broad in that it might provide a loophole for someone involved in criminal conduct to nonetheless obtain the benefits of immunity. For example, you may have a co-defendant or a co-conspirator who decides that he wants immunity and he could, for want of a better word, rat on his co-defendant and thereby possibly under Section 7 obtain immunity. And so we have proposed different language, which I believe is included in our written testimony here, which borrows from the mandatory child abuse reporting statute, which provides immunity for persons who report child abuse. And we have modeled language similar to that in our proposed amendment to this provision. I don't mean to suggest that wouldn't support some other type of amendment to this proposal. I've talked briefly with our state police counterparts in this, and I believe that they agree with that this needs to be amended and have some ideas about that as well. But I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have about this or any other provisions.
Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for, I was reading over your section on the immunity, and I thought you made some very good points. We certainly didn't want to have people using this as a loophole for criminal purposes, and I think tying it to the mandatory reporter statute is really a good move here, because it's all about good faith and that keeps people from abusing it. So I wanted to thank you for that. And Mr. Attorney General, I wanted to ask you on the precursor control issue. Right now, the way the bill is, we ban the tablets, because at the time we were putting this together, it appeared as though the tablets were so readily accessible to meth cooks, whereas the gels and liquid were difficult or more difficult. If they are all equal, do you have an opinion on what should be done with them? I mean, does it still make any sense to ban one form? I mean, from your information from the DEA, is it still more difficult or difficult enough to use the gels and liquids that we should still differentiate between the tablets, or is it your understanding that they're all pretty much equal at this point?
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, I have not actually seen the underlying report of the Drug Enforcement Administration. I've seen the news reports of it, but as I understand it, that report asserts that it is now being established scientifically that the liquid and gel forms, that pseudoephedrine can be extracted from them pretty readily. And so I think that the position I would advance respectfully to the committees is that the control structure that's extended to the other form of the product would be likewise extended alike to all forms. I think that ultimately we're heading for an outright ban on products containing pseudoephedrine, but I think this is going to be an incremental process. But for the near term, I think a the same control structure for all forms is what we would recommend.
We kind of thought the same thing on the work group. We just didn't expect the increments to come piling down so rapidly.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think that the report of the Drug Enforcement Administration caught a number of people by surprise. I think that there was widespread a conviction that there was indeed a significant difficulty in the extraction from those other forms, and I think that's reflected in the way the states heretofore have approached, like Oregon, including Oregon, have approached this. So.
Hardy, there was a lot of conversation in the work group before we had the original suggestion of outright ban of the hard tablets. And there seems, in our conversation, committee members and pharmaceutical people, leadership, I think to some degree, that perhaps making the hard tablets by prescription only, which many other forms of, drugs are currently regulated in that way. And then we had left in the bill the ability for the pharmaceutical board to regulate the gels and hard tabs in that they had emergency rule authority and administrative rule that they can do with public hearings much quicker than legislative action. Do you think that serves a good purpose at this time to do that?
Chair Krieger, Chair Burdick, yes, I believe so, if I understand your question, as long as they aren't precluded from doing it. I think it's a policy judgment for the legislature as to whether, if you believe that the similar regulation of all forms is good policy, whether you want to enact that directly or whether you want to leave that to administrative action. It's my understanding that the governor would intend to pursue it administratively if the assembly itself doesn't proceed.
And I know there's a lot of concern about that, but also in conversations with people, it appears that there are some alternative drugs coming to us. This is going to drive the research and development for drugs to take those places that maybe can't be used to make illegal substances. And so hopefully the discomfort or the inconvenience might be maybe a year to 2 years before we maybe have some better products on the, and I think we're going to hear maybe something about that today. Committee members, you got anything further?
Thank you very much.
You.
And again, sincerest congratulations to the work that's produced the amended measures. These are certainly rank as two of the most important measures the legislature has developed, and we, as I said, will be reporting back to you if we have any further issues that we think you ought to be made aware of, but we stand ready to try to work with the committees in any way we can to be helpful.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We're going to continue with our agenda from last night, the people who were kind enough to return today. We'll start with Una Swanson and Sue Abrams from the Department of Human Services. To the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Krueger, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'd like to say, first of all, that my name is Una Swanson. I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to, first of all, say how much we support the work of the Meth Task Force and the challenges that these bills are intended to do some good work with. And I am here today just to address a very small portion of 907-3. The area that I would like to just speak briefly about is Section 4. Section 4 is a part that addresses the mandatory reporter. It's adding a new category of abuse. And in Section 4 of Sub 1, Sub J, the new category of abuse is defined as exposure to a controlled substance as defined in ORS 475.005 that results in a child being a drug affected child. And the department understands and certainly supports the intent of what we believe this language is intended to result in, but we believe that the language may not be clear enough to reach that intent. We would like to respectfully offer an alternative language that may be more clear. we're suggesting that this language, an unlawful exposure to a controlled substance as defined in ORS 475-005 that subjects a child to substantial risk of harm to the child's health and safety, may in fact be more clear in terms of what we're talking about in this abuse category. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'm available to the community for questions if there are some.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Actually, I'm chairing. I get all confused sometimes. Under this language, a child who was exposed to, say, fumes from a meth lab going on in their house would fall into this as well. In other words, this would take into account exposure to the actual child after, you know, after they're born.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, in our discussion with our AG and our advice, we believe that this language might capture those situations where a child may be born having been exposed unlawfully to a substance, or would also capture those children who are in an environment where they've been exposed in an unlawful way to substances.
Okay, thank you. That's a positive change. So are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Ms. Abrams.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sue Abrams. I'm the administrator of the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits in the Children, Adults, and Families cluster of the Department of Human Services, and I'm the food stamp program director. And I was asked, actually, to come and talk to the committee about the sort of giving you some information about the food stamp regulations and law, and then some of the concerns we have, because while we there were some problems in prior language to, I think, a different piece of legislation that this amendment was put into, but we do have some concerns about even how this language is crafted now and some conflicts it might set up. Current federal regulations already allow us to disqualify somebody from food stamps who is not cooperating with the conditions of their parole or probation. It doesn't go into the detail that's now in this legislation. And in fact, some of this detail creates conflicts with another piece of federal law that requires a certain penalty for people who are found to be trafficking, using their benefits to traffic in drugs, and there's a whole set of penalties that happen. So this will create a conflict. And part of our concern is that we will now have a state legislation that your parole and probation officers will be following, and then our staff will have to follow federal regulations, and we may not get to the end that we want, which is really for them to be working together. So a couple of thoughts we had is that we don't think that this is needed to be in legislation for us to do what we believe the task force wants to see happen. And listening to the testimony last night and sort of the benefits of working together, especially if folks are going through drug courts and in treatment and working with the parole and probation officers and wanting to kind of have all these organizations working together to help people into recovery, we think we can already do that with the federal regulations we have. If we need to put more clarity to this, which we think we may need to do because there also is sort of an administrative hearings process that people are entitled to, we prefer doing that through an administrative rule rather than state statute. But if there's a feeling that this needs to be in state statute, we'd like to work with the task force to craft some language that won't be in conflict with federal regulations. So.
Sue, you indicate that you have currently this authority already. We've had a meth epidemic for at least 4 to 5 years in the state and oncoming for over 10. Do you know how many times food stamps have been suspended by people who have routinely been in violation of parole or agreements or recovery programs?
I don't have that information. I have talked with some folks. We think it probably does happen infrequently now. Some of that may be because parole and probation officers do not know about the federal regulation. Our staff know about it because it's in our policies. But somebody has to let us know that they're in violation. We do know that in some offices where there is some co-location, and because this law applies not just to food stamps, but it also applies to people who are on temporary assistance to needy families, that in some situations where they're working pretty closely with the probation or parole officer, there has been that. Benefits have been ended. Oftentimes not very long, because once that happens, then people do start cooperating and we can restore the benefits as soon as they are cooperating.
Do you have any way of recalling from any information that you have or records about the frequency or numbers of times, let's say in the last 5 years, that you could get for us?
No, I don't have that information.
No documentation at all?
No.
Okay.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wirt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question. I just want to verify that what's the single largest demographic in terms of the recipients of TANF and food stamps?
Chair Burdick and Krieger and Representative Worth, the single demographic, I'm not sure I...
Household type.
Well, most of the households on TANF are single women with children. And then on, I'm not sure on food stamps, although I believe families are a larger portion than single adults.
And so what percentage would you say, in terms of that demographic, what percentage are single mothers the recipients of public assistance here, if it's the biggest demographic?
Well, on TANF, I think it must be about 95%, because the other folks would be either two-parent households or a single father. And so the vast majority are single mothers. Although I believe about a quarter of our caseload now on TANF are relatives caring for children.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Have Rob Bovet and Greg Durbin come up, please.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin, and I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and currently serve as the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. And here today to testify on Senate Bill 907-2485 in support of those bills. I do want to applaud the work of the legislature this year. It's been an incredible amount of work, I know, on a lot of different areas in the ability to be able to compile all this legislation into two bills and figure out and try to put into place the pieces that would work to combat what we've all been hearing about, the three-legged stool. And I really believe that this legislation, in a lot of respects, will do just that. It will fix a lot of areas that need to be fixed. It will implement new areas and allow us, I believe, to really start to gain a foothold in the task we've all been trying to do and to crush methamphetamine. I would like to just touch on a few of the areas and then also touch on a few of the questions, if I could, from last night. One of the issues in this bill is the remediation of property, and that has been a problem, continues to be a problem. It is a problem out there with communities in the sense that we have many of these properties that are on the remediation list clear back into 1999, 98, 97, and these properties continue to be an eyesore in neighborhoods that are not being cleaned up. And typically they'll be just left. They'll have overgrowth of lawn and a lot of materials around, and the communities basically have to live with that eyesore around. There's no ability for that community to get that cleaned up, short of some programs that happen in some of the counties. And so that will help tremendously. The toxic dump sites, we've heard some of the statistics on the dump sites, but what we do know is that because there's about 6 pounds of sludge for every pound of methamphetamine produced, and if we have about 300 meth cooks, and I think that is a conservative number, the number is going down. We track the iodine MSM cells. We've been doing that since about 2000, and what we know is that at the time, at the peak, we could have had somewhere around 500 to 700 meth cooks operating in Oregon at any one time. I think those numbers are dropping down, but if we take just 300 meth cooks operating in Oregon, it could produce around 88,200 pounds of toxic sludge every year going into our aquifers, going into our farmlands, going into our streams, all those areas. Because the Meth Lab Cooker Survey from LA Impact Study shows that these people, what they like to do is typically dump this toxic sludge down the drain or bury it. That's their two favorite spots to do it. And I've personally been on many labs where they've done that. In fact, one of them, I remember, had a big pipe that they basically dumped all their toxic sludge right down to the nearest river that was right behind the house. Distribution of precursor substances. We had a case just recently with Damascus Feed Store, and this feed store supplied iodine to the Damascus, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. And what we found in that investigation, that was one of the investigations that we have one agent in my office that is tasked with precursor chemical investigations. And this would be the same type of investigations that we'd work with the Department of Justice on. But that person was tasked with those investigations, and we identified one of these stores that was selling to probably about three-quarters of the meth cooks in Clackamas County. And we were able to do a federal investigation on that, and that is in a federal system right now. There's about 400 gallons of iodine supplied in about a year and a half to those counties. Now, if you look at an animal hospital on an average will supply 2 gallons or use 2 gallons of iodine for all their treatment of all their animals a year. So this store supplied over 400 gallons to those communities. So we'll be able to now conduct those type of investigations and really focus on those distribution cases. Sudafedrin. I'd like to talk a little bit about sudafedrin and what I spoke about to the Board of Pharmacy yesterday. We are at a very fortuitous time in this legislation and in dealing with the sudafedrin products. We testified before the Board of Pharmacy and the legislature already this year, in the sense that these labs, and Rob will talk about this more, is that the sudafedrin issue is more of a law enforcement support issue than it is to actually stop the flow of methamphetamine. As you've heard, there's different estimates that maybe 20% of the meth or 35% of the meth is actually made at these small toxic labs, and that's true. However, and Rob will talk about that, this is where all of our problems have been caused, by the children being exposed to these chemicals, the possibility of explosion, the damage to all of our environment and all those things. And what we've done by locking up the sudafedrin so far, the tablet form, is that we're holding steady at about 50% reduction. Now, that 50% is affected, and it could be a lot lower, but the problem is that in Umatilla, Multnomah County, Baker, the border counties, they're still suffering because the people are going into other states and getting their sudafedrin, and that's an issue that we're going to try to work with Washington and Idaho. In fact, we're setting up a tri-state committee and with some of the AG's offices to start working on those things as well. But they are suffering. But what the interior count parts of Oregon will tell you, and I talk with these task forces, is that they said, wow, we've actually not had a meth lab in some of the counties since the beginning of the year. And their estimates are well above probably 70-80% reduction since the implementation of this law. What that's been able to do is now they're able to focus on the people that are bringing methamphetamine into our state. For the first time, they're really starting to focus in on that. And since that time, what they found is they've seized, I've talked to three different task forces, and three of them told me the same thing. They've seized more crystal methamphetamine in the first quarter of this year than they did all of last year. Now, there's two things with that. One is that we're being absolutely flooded with crystal methamphetamine, the whole United States is. But the other thing is that they're able to focus on these drug trafficking organizations. Now, that is why we are very concerned with what has happened just recently with gel caps and liquids. We actually, unfortunately, because we've been seeing methamphetamine for about the last 20 years, we are unfortunately do have some of the best meth cooks in the United States. And these people, is what I testified yesterday was, is that what we found was, is that we have a group called the National Meth Chemicals Initiative, and we work together. In fact, we're going to be leaving next week to go to that and testifying there, or doing a presentation there. But what we found was, is that every time we clamped down on a precursor chemical, that very shortly these people would figure out another way to make their methamphetamine. And an example of that is, we were able to clamp down on red phosphorus. And what they did was, is then, because they have all this time on their hands, they just took and ripped off match striker plates all day long, dumped them into a solvent, and then scraped them to get enough red phosphorus to cook their methamphetamine. And they did that very quickly. Now what has happened is that in Oregon, since we clamped down on the tablet and the powder pseudoephedrine, and it really does not matter what type you have, and in this packet, my testimony here, if you go to the third page, this is one website that we watch, and I took the website information off because I really don't want to put that out there. But what they do is that as soon as we start controlling some of these things, very shortly you'll see another recipe pop up on how to circumvent what we've done. And if you look on here, the pseudoephedrine that they use in this recipe is time release. And we were told before, just worry about the single ingredient pseudoephedrine. And we argued, no, you've got to worry about the multi-ingredient, you've got to worry about the single ingredient, because the multi-ingredient is primarily what they're using. We were able to prove that through our cards that are submitted down to the MPASL Intelligence Center. And so we pulled multi-ingredient, we pulled the single ingredient, and we decided we, the gel caps and labs, or we did not want to fight the gel caps and liquid issue until we started seeing a problem. And again, we also did not think that we would see a problem that quickly. But unfortunately, because these meth cooks are very quick to figure out how to circumvent the system, in Oregon, we had the honor of, in St. Helens, the first gel cap lab. And I included pictures here. And this is what it looked like when they took this lab down. And these pictures are of that lab, and this person was attempting to dissolve the gel caps in a liquid. And in fact, this cook was able to do so, and it was tested positive for pseudoephedrine. Well, this precipitated the study that you heard about already with DEA and with the Washington State Patrol Lab. They both said, we've got to deal with this, because what was happening with Oklahoma and all the other states trying to control pseudoephedrine, we need to look at this and see if gel caps and liquids are a problem as well. So they did their study. And what they found was is that actually, yes, it was not difficult to extract pseudoephedrine from gel caps and liquids. All they needed to do was one extra step, and in fact, from gel caps, they could get 68% pseudoephedrine. So that information has gone out, went out across the United States. At that point, we decided that we needed to start asking the legislature and asking the Board of Pharmacy to deal with the gel caps and liquid issue. Well, just yesterday morning, I was notified that one of our troopers back in April stopped a vehicle, and in that vehicle was a lab, and in that was some liquid. And in that liquid, the person who they stopped said he actually was on tape, and he said that he used Vicks Formula 44D to get his pseudoephedrine. And so they took and had him point to the liquid that he said contained this cough syrup where he got his pseudoephedrine. They took and sent that to our lab, and I just heard that our lab results are positive for pseudoephedrine. So the word is out. The word is out that you can get pseudoephedrine from gel caps and liquids. And they are going now to probably have this on the website very shortly. And that word through the meth community, because the meth community is very interlinked, they're all going to know it. And if we leave that out over the counter, we do not pull that in, all they're going to do is just turn to that, and we will have thefts, we will have labs, we will have all the problems that we've been able to cut in half already, and we're going to be exposing our children and our communities to those labs. One of the disturbing, real disturbing things, besides the pseudoephedrine, now one of the, just one other thing I wanted to cover was on with meth cooks. There was a question about sentencing of the meth cooks, and I do applaud and I do think that we're going to have a significant impact on the second time meth offenders, putting them away from 19 months. However, on the first time cooks, just one thing to consider is that you have in a book that we gave to you back in Pendleton, in that book there's a meth lab cooker survey that was done down in LA. And what they found was with these meth cooks is that typically they would cook about about 5 years before they would make that conscious decision to decide to cook. And during that 5 years, they were being arrested for possession, for identity theft, for all those different crimes. And then somewhere around 5 years, they would start cooking. Well, once they started cooking, 79% said they'd never been arrested for cooking meth once they were finally caught. So they, at that, during all the other different times, they were being arrested for possession, identity theft, all those other crimes, but they were not being caught with the lab. And I can understand that because when I ran task forces, it was very difficult to catch someone with a lab. It was really difficult. So they were able to cook all this time. And what they would do is every year they would teach about four others to cook. And they would cook 49 to 72 times per year. So they're teaching a lot of people to cook. They're cooking a lot. And they're out there not being caught. So they are the bad of the bad as far as in the meth world. And if we could deal with them on that first time, I think it would be a very good thing to be able to deal with that. The last thing I wanted to just touch on, and then I'll let Rob talk, is that yesterday Katie Suver from the Marion County District Attorney's Office brought up an issue with some of the wording in Senate Bill 907 and in Section 8 in particular, Section A. And it talks about here about 30 grams of an ingestible and marketable form of methamphetamine. And I do believe that that is a problem. And the reason for that is in your packet, I included a picture here. In this picture, it is kind of a glamour shot, but it was when I had YSENT, the Yamhill County narcotics team that I ran for about 4 years. And we had, this lab was a super lab. It was Mexican nationals that were brought in to cook. And they had, in 4 days' time, they had enough methamphetamine here. It's actually 60 pounds of methamphetamine, over $1 million on the street. But when we kicked the door and found this, all this solid right here that you see is methamphetamine. That's in your packet here as the picture. That's methamphetamine. But where that was at the time when we kicked the door was in these buckets suspended in a liquid. And we had our chemists from the crime lab actually stick the hydrochloric acid into the liquid that bubbles it up, precipitates it, makes it into a solid. But at the time, when it was in this liquid, it was not ingestible and it was not marketable. So you could actually have had 60 pounds of methamphetamine suspended in liquid there, and this wording would not fit for that lab. So it's, and most of the labs that we hit, a lot of times the actual methamphetamine is still suspended in the liquid when we hit the door. And so that would not fit in that area. I applaud all your efforts, and I appreciate what you're doing. I think we are on the forefront. We're receiving calls from across the nation, from the Drug Czar's office, from all over the place, and what we're doing and asking about our ability to gather statistics and our legislation, those type of things. And as I mentioned, that Rob and I next week will do a presentation before a national committee on what we're doing here in Oregon. So the word is spreading, and I think we're going to do some good things. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Craig, on your two examples you gave us as to seeing where both the liquid and the gel form is now being used, and you said that the substance tested positive. I understand that we've had in a control situation results of showing 65% purity. Do you know what the actual amount of purity was, what the actual result was in those two Oregon cases?
In the liquids that they tested, Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, in the liquid that they tested, no, we do not know what the purity was. It was detectable pseudoephedrine. What that means is that a lot of times our lab actually does not test the purity like the DEA lab does. But what that does mean is that once they were able to dry that out, that they would have the pseudoephedrine or that they would need in order to conduct the cook. So they were able to do that. And again, in this statement that this cook did, he said that the night before that he had cooked methamphetamine and made product from what he was doing.
Okay, if I could just follow up. So just for the record, what you're giving us was just changing at the end of the form of pseudoephedrine to be used for a cook of meth. It wasn't actually the meth that had been confiscated through that those two times.
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, correct. What they do is, whether it's tablet, and now that we know gel caps and liquids, all they do is that with a tablet, what they're doing is they grind it up, they take and then they run it through a process to be able to pull out all the base and the time release and all those things to get to the pseudoephedrine. Same thing in the gel caps and liquids. They're going through a process that I've seen the report from WSP, I've seen the report from DEA, and again, it's not that complicated. They go through a process, and then they just end up with what we call their their base or their pseudoephedrine, and then they take and add, whether on the other side of the mountains they add their anhydrous and those chemicals, or on this side they add their red phosphorus and iodine and those chemicals, and then they make their methamphetamine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sounds pretty straightforward. Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, you had submitted to us a report that was from the Oregon high-intensity drug trafficking area. In the executive summary, there was just a statement in there that stood out to me, but I didn't see it explained, and I'm wondering if you could back it up. It says on page 3, abuse and treatment data are not encouraging. Do you want to expound upon that?
Chair Burdick, Representative Thatcher, this was written by Chuck Carl of the HIDA. He is the director of the Oregon HIDA. And I believe what he is saying there is that just highlights that we have a problem in Oregon. It's not that the treatment is not encouraging, but that we have a problem in Oregon.
I have a follow-up.
Please do.
Also on the next page 4, and this should be a pretty quick answer too, my understanding that the Oregon medical marijuana law presents a major barrier to effective enforcement and prosecution efforts. Is that...
Chair Burdick and Representative Thatcher, yes. It creates difficulty in a number of areas, and when we've talked about this, because I am also on the Legislative Advisory Committee for that as well. And with law enforcement, there is a whole variety of problems that the Oregon medical marijuana law creates for law enforcement in areas of gaining search warrants, probable cause, affirmative defense issues, and many others. And so it is very difficult to enforce those type of laws.
Another question. On the last page, on page 5, on the very top paragraph in the middle of it, it says that methamphetamine trafficking is increasingly being dominated by Mexican drug trafficking organizations. Do we have any, and I notice on the committee, this HIDA, is that what you call it? Committee is, actually the board, the executive board, includes an acting resident agent in charge for ICE. Do we have any sort of agreements with them that when we catch these people who are most probably here illegally, and trafficking this scourge, do we have a way of bringing in the federal government in dealing with this so we don't have to take the brunt of it ourselves here in Oregon?
Chair Burdick, Representative Thatcher, that's a very difficult issue with law enforcement because we are not able to enforce those laws. But typically, the ICE sits on the board, and they are involved in several of the initiatives, which means that you have a group of law enforcement that submits a particular target or of where they're going to target as far as the drugs or particular counties within our state. And we have those representatives on some of those task forces or initiatives. And if those cases involve Mexican nationals and they're aware of it, then they will take the steps that are needed to be taken. But we do have significant what we call drug trafficking organizations operating in Oregon. If you notice on page 4 at the bottom there are over 99 identified drug trafficking organizations in Oregon. And so Oregon is, and it's pretty surprising, Oregon is recognized across the nation as a significant source of drug trafficking, both by the Drug Czar's office, by what we call OCDEF for federal funding, and by HIDA as well. And we have some very large cases that come out of here for what typically happens is either drugs coming up from the south across the I-5 corridor and coming up here and then being broken up and sent across the rest of the nation, or drugs coming down, cocaine and marijuana from California coming down here, again being broken up and sent across the nation. And so that's a very significant number, and it's comparative to the population size that we have.
Follow up, please. One more. Thank you. Now, when you said that we are not able to enforce those laws here, are you talking about the immigration laws? And if you're saying that we, is it just anomaly for Oregon that we are not able to enforce those laws? Or is it pretty common across the states that they can enforce those laws?
Chair Burdick, Representative Thatcher, correct. It's across the United States, not specific to Oregon.
Okay.
We cannot ask immigration status and those type of things of people that we come in contact with. So That's typically what typically happens on a if we were to receive information. And let's say I have a task force and we receive information, we might be dealing with some Mexican nationals. Then we could invite the Immigration and Customs with us on that raid and those type of things, and then they would take appropriate action. But there's many barriers for us that precludes us from doing that.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? I had his methamphetamine. I have no idea how long pseudoephedrine has even existed. Has methamphetamine always been made from pseudoephedrine?
Chair Burdick, no, it has not. The methamphetamine back in the 70s when California first started to see it and we started to see it was made from what's called phenyl-2-propanolamine. And after there was federal legislation that cracked down very significantly on that and pretty much just stopped it. Well, right about that same time is when pseudoephedrine came out.
What was the legal purpose of that word I can't pronounce?
What was the legal purpose?
Yeah, phenylpropanolamine.
It's actually not. The phenylpropanolamine is another decongestant. Phenyl-2-propanone is actually the precursor substance.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
Racemic meth, that is a different type of meth, and we can talk more about that if you want a little later.
Well, I guess the reason I asked is because, you know, we're kind of headed down a road where I would not be at all surprised if 5 years from now we were pseudoephedrine was gone. And, you know, all the cold medications were alternatives. I guess my question is, how have you already identified other drugs that might be adapted, other active ingredients, other precursors? If we did get rid of pseudoephedrine, will we just be switching the arena to another active ingredient? Have you seen any signs of that yet?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'll defer to Rob on most of that, but what I can say is that based on a lot of things that are happening, I think that could they make some other designer drug in the future that, you know, there's a good chance, and we'll have to deal with that as we go. But as far as making methamphetamine, this type of methamphetamine, I would say no at this point. And we are going to be dealing with the influx because I don't believe that down in Mexico and those type of things that they're going to completely stop the cartels. And it's kind of a new phenomenon down there. Just what has happened just recently is that up until about 2001, a lot of the cartels down in Mexico were not interested in methamphetamine production. They were still dealing with cocaine and marijuana and those type of things. They had some labs down there, but not near what they have now. And since about the first of 2000 is when they really started to crank up production and start with this crystal form of meth, which, as we all know, is how addictive it is and those type of things. So that's... I truly believe that the efforts that we're doing with the small toxic labs are going to have very, very significant impact for our abilities as law enforcement in this state. Because if we were not doing what we're doing right now, the epidemic that we would see, it would just be absolutely devastating. Because what scares us right now to death in law enforcement is this crystal form. Because it's so potent, so addictive, but what the problem with that is with the children. It's getting in, and we're hearing reports over and over and over, and more so of middle schoolers and high schoolers using this because the stigma where before the powdered form they had to snort, they had to eat, or they had to inject, and typically children or children, their children, do not want to do that. But to smoke it, is not that big of a step from going from cigarettes, or if they're smoking marijuana, as we know is our second highest treatments for juveniles right now in the state. So it's not that big of a step to smoking methamphetamine, and so that's what's scary.
So the crystal meth comes pre-made from Mexico, or is it made here?
Correct, it's pre-made. So it comes in, and it's ready to be smoked. And the powder that we dealt with was about 20% pure. Right now, every DEA does get purity coming across the border, and what they say is that everything that's coming across the border right now is 94% pure.
Okay, so. Thank you. Maybe this would be a good segue to Mr. Bovet. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. For the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing. First, I want to applaud the committee and the staff for putting together what, at least is, in my opinion, the most comprehensive and powerful anti-meth legislation at a state level that I've ever seen. And we've been monitoring this pretty closely around the nation for a long time. So this is amazing stuff. You've heard some minor adjustments that need to be made to various sections. I have submitted for the record some testimony and support for making some adjustments to Section 10 of the substitute House Bill 2485, which is the pseudoephedrine piece, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But and I will be very brief here and supplement with just some things that you haven't heard, hopefully. And I'm going to do the old bait and switch right now, but I promise to switch right back. The bait and switch is this. These are, in fact, I just got them 2 days ago, the latest five methamphetamine awareness project student-directed, produced, and created television commercials from Oregon high schools and, for the first time, a middle school. And four of these were premiered at a small public forum, and one of them has never been premiered, and I'll premiere them here for you here in a moment. So that's the bait and switch. What I've got for you to show before that is some more further explanation about pseudoephedrine and maybe try to answer some of the questions that came up yesterday. And I call this a new hope. I call what you've put together and what you've done here a new hope for a lot of reasons. And I'm not talking about Star Wars Episode 4, of course. I'm talking about the good old three-legged stool of prevention, treatment, and enforcement. You mentioned briefly a moment ago, Representative, the treatment data. The hard truth is that in Oregon, we rank number four for treatment access for young adults ages 18 to 25, and we rank number 49 in the nation for treatment resources to serve those same folks. So we have number four in terms of addiction needs and treatment services, and we are at number 49 in the services to provide that treatment. What you heard a lot about yesterday, and I won't bore you with the details of it, is the treatment works. The correct treatment actually works. And just like the bumper sticker says, drug courts work, and I applaud you for pursuing this. There are plenty of additional things that we need to be doing beyond treatment, which is support services. And you heard from the Thugs Off Drugs yesterday about a very excellent program that they're expanding around the state of Oregon. You also heard briefly about the nurseries that are existing in Lane County that can do this, that same type of work. And that's all powerful stuff, great stuff. We also need to bolster and re-bolster our law enforcement resources. In the last 10 years, we've lost 35% of our narcotics teams and 45% of our narcotics officers. That's not bolstering that leg of the stool. So that's kind of bad news. We got bad news on the treatment side, but these bills go a long ways to trying to restore those. What I'd like to really talk about, and that's the bait and switch, is the prevention piece, because there were some questions yesterday about what are we doing in terms of prevention in the schools, and I think there's a lot of great stuff that's going on that folks just haven't noticed. One of the other things I will mention just real briefly is the federal legislation. There were questions about, well, gosh, we're doing all this stuff with pseudoephedrine, getting rid of the local meth labs. They're producing 35% of the meth. What about all that stuff that's being brought in? Well, that's really a federal question, and we need to be dealing with it at a federal and even an international level. And you need to know that the governor's meth task force looked at that very hard and very heavily. And there are currently, in my opinion, six pieces of federal legislation that have been submitted to effectively deal with that. A number of them are covered by the Oregonian in the past few articles. And you also need to know that each and every one of those six stem from the work originally of the Oregon Governor's Meth Task Force, and were introduced by our senators and our representatives, most notably the joint efforts of Senator Smith and Wyden, and in particular Congressman Hooley and Congressman Greg Walden, a bipartisan effort to provide legislation that will help us combat meth at an international and a national level. Because, yes, we can cut down on the number of meth labs in Oregon, and we can get 100% or close to 100% elimination of local mom-and-pop meth labs in the interior counties of Oregon. But until and unless we do something national in terms of pseudoephedrine control, we're still going to have bleeding across state borders because meth knows no borders. Move on from there. Just talk, and here's the danger, here's my disclaimer. In talking about pseudoephedrine control to reduce methamphetamine labs, the local mom-and-pop labs, there's always a risk that people will say, hey, you know what? This is not going to eliminate the meth epidemic. This is not the answer to the meth epidemic. Well, guess what? We never claimed it would be. This is simply an answer, the most effective, proven, established answer in the nation to reducing the incidence of meth labs, which is just one piece of our meth epidemic, and it does that incredibly effective. And the evidence that is essentially irrefutable at this point in time from Oklahoma and Oregon does just that, and that's why five other states in the last 2 months have adopted similar models based on the Oklahoma and Oregon experience. With that being said, to answer your question, I guess we already kind of answered it. Pseudoephedrine is the key ingredient necessary to make what we call dextrorotary methamphetamine. That's the crystal, the ice, the stuff that is powerfully addictive, much more powerful than anything else that's out there, including crack cocaine. The old methamphetamine, it's called racemic meth. I won't get into the pharmacology of it, but it's a different drug. It's functionally a different drug. If it reappeared, it wouldn't have nearly the power of anything that we've seen here, even cocaine. I strongly suspect it won't reappear because it just doesn't have that kind of kick. If you're interested, this is what ephedrine and pseudoephedrine look like, and I'll just flash past that really quick. That's the difference between pseudoephedrine and methamphetamine if you're into the pharmacology. Now, I won't spend much time with this, but it's just one single oxygen atom that sits right there. That's pseudoephedrine, that's methamphetamine. Getting a little bit better with these PowerPoint presentations, we'll see if this flies. This is a meth lab from a pharmacological standpoint. That's pseudoephedrine. First step is to remove what's called a hydroxyl group, the hydrogen-oxygen group. Just add back hydrogen. That's the difference between methamphetamine and pseudoephedrine. Now, it looks really simple on paper or in a PowerPoint presentation, but it's incredibly toxic, incredibly dangerous in real life, and you have to essentially be mixing the strongest acids, strongest bases, strongest solvents, and you have to be pretty much close to insane or at least addicted to methamphetamine for 5 to 6 years before you'll ever do this to yourself, your home, and your children. Here's my second disclaimer, and again, it goes along the same theme. These numbers are adjusted based on the latest federal data. Yes, it is true that the local mom-and-pop meth labs on the left-hand side only produce 35% of the meth that's on the street. And we could be attacked for going after those because we're not going after, you know, the big international meth labs, the super labs. Two responses. One, we are going after the super labs, and that's the federal legislation I mentioned, and we're pushing hard for it, and our entire congressional delegation on a bipartisan level is pushing hard for it as well. The second thing is that this rule is designed to go after what's on the left-hand side, the meth labs. Those are 96% of the meth labs that are out there. That's what this rule is aimed at doing, and that's what Section 10 of House Bill 2485, the substitute, goes after, and I applaud you for pursuing this issue very aggressively, and you need to be pursuing it as aggressive as you're doing. These are the ones that pollute our environment, toxify homes, poison the children. These are the ones we have to get rid of. They drain law enforcement resources, and again, they poison the children and toxify the environment. Okay, so enough of that. Before I move on to MAP and show you these videos, which are just really, I got to just make one real comment. What a better way to educate children about the dangers of methamphetamine than through children? That's the foundation of MAP. But I'll describe it for you, and I'll show you these five.
Rob, before you do, sure. How long are these videos?
30 seconds each. They're television commercials.
Cool.
And there's five of them.
All right.
I got to just to amplify something that Craig already mentioned. Pseudoephedrine. We used to originally, the song and dance we heard from the pharmaceuticals way back when was only regulate the single active ingredient. We heard that year in, year out. It was a myth. It had never had any foundation. In fact, law enforcement defeated that in many states. In some states, they actually bought into the argument for whatever reason, and it's just a bunch of bunk, and it was always a bunch of bunk. Really, meth cooks don't care. Combo ingredients, single ingredients, they just all put in the same pot together, crush it up, separate it out. And that's true for the long-acting ones as well, 12-hour decongestants. Then it's just all the same. In fact, I know of many meth cooks that prefer the Actifed and generic equivalents and the extended ones because it doesn't have the red dye, and so their meth comes out clear instead of red. So it really never made a difference. Those were myths that were perpetuated. I think we're done with those myths. Hopefully we're done with those myths. The one that we were going with, as Craig mentioned before, was the liquids and the gels because it does require a couple of additional steps, and we thought it would take them a while to figure it out. Well, it didn't, regrettably. And so they figured it out, and the liquids and the gels, all these products now all need to be treated the same. Because to a meth cook, they are the same. They don't matter. They can get the pseudoephedrine out of any of those. To answer Chair Krieger's question a little bit ago, maybe it'll take a year or two to get the substitute products on the market. They're there. They're there already. Instead of having Sudafed, with pseudoephedrine. We now have Sudafed PE all over the shelf, and we have the generic equivalents as well. And I bought, I spent $4.99 for the Pfizer product, but I bought the generic equivalents for a buck. I mean, so it's filling the shelves now. The reason, and we also still have the products that used to be there, and you know, as the alternatives to pseudoephedrine even before the pseudoephedrine issue came up. So there really isn't any longer any justification to treat any pseudoephedrine product differently, and there's no longer a justification to keep any of this stuff anywhere out there beyond the pharmacy counter.
So are you advocating a ban on all of them?
If you read my testimony, what I basically conclude is that at this point in time, we're not asking for a ban. I know that that's what the draft says. We think you should back off that, allow the pharmacy board to do the controlled substance scheduling, require a prescription for it, but treat them all the same. As I mentioned before, there is now no longer a justification for treating any pseudoephedrine product differently than any others, because they're making meth out of all of them. And so there shouldn't be any distinction among and between those products. And I have provided you a draft alternative to Section 10 for you to consider that would do just that. It would use the existing language where I can, as created by legislative counsel, and then treat all of the products the same. I think it's simpler. I think it's easier. I think it makes more sense from a controlled substance scheduling perspective, from a practical standpoint for the pharmacists, and I think that's where the pharmacy board is heading.
Of course, the struggle we have with that, and we will talk about that with others as well, is the person with allergies who lives 40, 50 miles away from a pharmacy.
Well, but it's already there. I mean, we've already got, the products are already on the shelf, and they're just based on phenylephrine rather than pseudoephedrine. So if they live, you know, if they live 5 minutes from the convenience store, they should be able to pick up this stuff right now because it's already on the market. I mean, I've bought all this stuff. It's all, the generics are filling the shelf space, and there's a strong economic incentive for the pharmaceutical companies to compete and produce these products now because they get the shelf space back. Right now, Pfizer and the generic equivalents of those products pretty much got an exclusive lock on a lot of the shelf space, but that's changing. It's in a rapid process of changing. So, you know, for grandma that's out there 200 miles from nowhere and she's only got a convenience store, she can still get the products that she's known and loved. It just has a different active ingredient. In fact, it's marketed and functionally looks the same, except it's just got this PE on the end for phenylephrine instead of pseudoephedrine. Pfizer has switched over entirely, so the entire Sudafed line, whether you realize it or not, doesn't contain pseudoephedrine anymore, or soon will, nothing will contain pseudoephedrine from the Sudafed line. I think they're still in the process of switching it all over, but it's all going to be phenylephrine-based. And I think they do that for a strong economic reason, because they want the shelf space back, but I think they also see the trend that you've pointed out a minute ago, and that was in the, I just noticed the Oregonian editorial this morning, you know, the world needs a new cold pill. Well, and I got news for the Oregonian. The world already has a new cold pill. It's called phenylephrine. It's out there. Pfizer's marketing. The generics have been selling it for a while. And we need to strongly encourage others to do the same. And I think the way we do that is to let them have their shelf space back with the phenylephrine and other alternative products. And that's the way we do that. And, you know, and I'll before I show you the map videos here, which I'm very excited to show you.
Sure.
I'm
sitting on the edge of my feet here, Rob. I'm ready for the.
You're ready for him?
You need to see the videos.
You need to see the videos.
I mean, I think you got a captive audience.
Captive audience. They're just waiting.
With you.
Yeah,
okay.
We're running a little short of time.
All right. So I won't give you the last book. MAP, and I'll just go through this real quickly. Methamphetamine Awareness Project. It is the brainchild, because I have to give credit what credit is due. It's the brainchild of the Oregon Partnership and the Northwest Film Center. That they were the ones that originally created it. It's all about meth awareness videos produced, written, and directed by students. And again, for the reasons I already mentioned, they get hands-on skills in learning how to make films. In fact, many of the MAP students move on to film school because it's such an exciting project.
Were there any meth users or recovering meth users involved in this that you know of?
Yeah, in fact, one of the PSAs revolves around interviewing an ex-meth user.
All right, hurry up.
Excellent
Rob.
Question.
Hurry
up. If you want to see it, learn the facts about meth, do all that great stuff. They get great video equipment they get to keep.
Cool.
Heck, a lot of fun.
That's all cool.
2003, Sheridan's where they started. I'm bleeding it here. And I'm sure many of you have seen the 2003 Sheridan video. 16-minute, powerful stuff. Newburgh High School produced two. I'm sure everybody has seen the PSAs they produced. You didn't realize it was produced by high school kids. Here's the four schools, and I'll just mention the middle school real quickly, Taft Middle School, the very first middle school to participate. And as Craig mentioned already, meth is all over the middle schools now, whether you like to hear it or not. One of the stories got leaked out here from Salem, where, you know, 12 middle school girls were trading sex for meth. But I can tell you, it's happening all over the state of Oregon. In fact, right as we sit here today, there's a trial going on in another county involving middle school kids and high school kids trading sex for meth. So anyways, okay, so that's it. So you want to see these things.
Yep. Dim the lights, please.
Okay. The first one is Newport High School. They produced a series of four PSAs, all based on the interview of ex-recovering meth addicts.
When it comes to methamphetamine, once you start it, you think you are in charge. I guarantee you. You think you are in charge the whole time, and then all of a sudden one day, you're lost. Because before you know it, you are so addicted you can't stop it. I hurt people that mean a lot to me. I have nightmares about it. All over a bag of chemicals. I'll regret the day I touched the stuff.
This is South Middle School.
One day I was outside waiting for the bus when I saw my friend talking to some lowlifes that used meth. I grabbed her and said, "Don't you know there's a lot better things to do than meth? There's going to games and watching the halftime shows. There's hanging out and talking with friends. There's going downtown to catch great movies. And don't forget dances where you can listen to music and have fun. Anything is better than getting hung up on meth, because meth is death. Don't do it."
Pretty good stuff for middle school kids, huh?
No kidding.
Toledo High School produced two.
This is Bobby. These are the people that care for you. Life was good for until it started going downhill. Everyone tried to help. Nothing worked. He lost his mentors and counselors, his coaches and teammates, friends and lovers, best friends and family. Mom always left with some song.
Toledo actually produced the second one, and we asked you to finish it, and I think you'll know why. It doesn't say a word, doesn't need to.
Powerful.
Walport High School.
I used to have it all. I had just turned 18, had gotten my independence, had lots of friends, played sports, and had a great education. But then, I made a life-changing decision. I went to a party after a big game. My friends decided to try something new. I thought one time wouldn't hurt, but I was wrong.
There you have it, the next five. It's going to go to a couple different schools next year. A couple of those have already been airing on KPTV 12. In 2 weeks' time, they'll be airing on Channel 6, and I think a couple of the other stations are going to pick them up as well. So,
well, thank you for bringing those. It's impressive. I mean, kids know how to reach kids. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
We have Representative Roblin in the audience. I think one of your schools, unless I'm wrong, was one of those ads.
No, we didn't have any of those, but I was just going to say the local courts asked us to do when Ballot Measure 11 came out, because we have a film class too, and they made a whole series of Measure 11 issues so that all the county schools would get a DVD and show kids what could happen if you made a bad choice and how easy it would be to get yourself in trouble. And it worked quite well, actually. Kids talked
about it. Could you identify yourself for the record? Thank you.
Chair Burdick and the rest of the committee, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am a representative from House District 9, which is the Coos Bay to Florence area, and I am pleased to be here today. Before I get started with my little bit of testimony that I wanted to say here, I did want to say, having been a principal of a high school at Marshall and Coos Bay, zero tolerance for any kind of drugs, but meth is probably the worst, and it took a while for kids
because it was a frightening drug even to kids for a while. It is not getting that way any longer, and it is a frightening thing to watch. And on a personal note, I have a brother who has struggled with this and has been in prison and is currently in prison twice because of his involvement with methamphetamines. And so as a family, we have dealt with this. My other three brothers and sisters have been dealing with this in many, many different ways. He's been through a number of treatments. It's a difficult thing to ever really deal with. There are treatments that work, and he has been at times clear for a while, but continues to make really bad choices. We continue to work. It is an unbelievably destructive drug. And so in that, I just want to say the production and use of methamphetamines is a critical problem on the south coast of Oregon, and it must be addressed. As residents of Coos Bay, I have seen firsthand the pervasive and destructive nature of methamphetamines in our communities. According to many statistics, 75% to 90% of Oregon crime deals with methamphetamines. And in talking to our local police, they would say it's in the upper 90% if it's a property crimes. Either through the use, dealing, or production, it is a problem that affects everyone in our area, either directly or indirectly. Because of the size, scope of this issue, we must address it at the local, state, and national levels. Given the pervasiveness of this drug and the drastic effects it has on communities in the South Coast and all of Oregon, I want to take your attention to one part of the meth package, specifically Section 9 of Senate Bill 907, which calls for the creation of a methamphetamine task force within the Attorney General's office. This task force, which would include, I think, an analyst and two attorneys, I think is key. Ballot Measure 3 and the loss of some of the money that helped our SCENT teams and our special prosecutors in our local area that worked specifically on meth has resulted in a need to get the knowledge back, and I think the Attorney General's office is the place to get that, to help statewide with prosecuting and analyzing the issues that around the state that can help us identify where problems exist and how to go after it. So I truly appreciate that part of this. This task force will help set up, investigate, and prosecute important methamphetamine cases around the state of Oregon. This does two things. First, it gives small communities the resources needed to prosecute methamphetamine cases. And second, it ensures judicious approach to the state-level fight on methamphetamine epidemic. This piece of legislation is a crucial first step in resolving the methamphetamine problem that exists in the South Coast and throughout this great state. And then one last little personal note. My wife's an elementary principal, and the other day, it's been about a month ago now, she got an alert from the bus driver that there were men with automatic arms and all, and that they couldn't get through to collect some of the kids because there was obviously the National Guard and everybody were involved. There was a large bust, which included a number of people being arrested in our area and in Portland and others through a case that was broke by a group on our local SCENT team in cooperation with other state officials. It was a fairly large bust. It resulted in a number of arrests, and it shows the extent that these organized groups that are bringing methamphetamines go to. Many people thought that the introduction to our state came on the I-5 corridor and weren't that excited about stuff on the coast. This case, which our people have known for years, indicated they're bringing it in lots of different ways, and Highway 101 is just as convenient for them as other ways. And so they were connected to people throughout the state. It is a serious problem, and I really want to commend all the people on this committee and the workforces that have done so much work to bring all the bills together. When I was talking with Representative Krieger at the beginning and seeing so many bills, I couldn't figure out how this was all going to come to pass. But the work you have done looking at these two bills is really remarkable. It is one of those things where you see how bipartisan work together on a crucial issue that faces the state of Oregon can happen and work when people all work together. So I commend you for that and stand ready to answer any questions if people have them.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Roblin? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Blake Rice and Gary Schnabel. Hope I pronounced that right.
As close as anybody gets.
Schnabel. Okay, I knew it was one or the other. I'm usually wrong when I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gary Schnabel, Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I bring apologies from Blake Rice, who's the President of the Oregon Board. We had board meetings in Portland yesterday and Tuesday, and he was up there for that, and we were here last night. He's unable to be here today, so he sent me to speak on his behalf.
Well, please send our regrets that we weren't able to get to everyone last night.
He wanted me to tell you that he's not here out of lack of interest, that not because he doesn't think this is important, but he had to work. He's unable to get away. He's the owner of a independent community pharmacy and had to staff the pharmacy today. He wouldn't want you to tell me this, but I think it's worth commenting. It costs him in the neighborhood of $1,000 a day to staff his pharmacy so he can leave and come to a board meeting. He does that every time he comes up to a meeting.
And our appreciation for his work.
I guess the real reason I'm here is to just tell you about what the Board of Pharmacy did yesterday. We had our regularly scheduled meeting, and we had a pretty full agenda, but because of the recent information about liquid and gel cap pseudoephedrine preparations, we were able to squeeze that topic onto the agenda. So we didn't have the whole day on it, but we got some time for that topic, and we had time to hear a presentation from the governor, and we got a chance to hear from Rob Babette and Craig Durbin, and have a fair amount of discussion among the board. The board members understand the problem very well, and this board has dealt with amphetamine precursors at various times as far back as 1990. In 1990, ephedrine was the primary precursor, and it was an over-the-counter decongestant, very similar to pseudoephedrine. And at that time, the board, by rule, made ephedrine a prescription-only product. And that worked. It was ephedrine required a prescription from that point on, and it essentially disappeared from the meth labs. And that's the point where pseudoephedrine became the primary precursor. When people couldn't no longer get ephedrine, they turned to pseudoephedrine. At that time, it was fairly quiet, and there wasn't a groundswell of support, and the board was, you know, somewhat speaking to deaf ears, mostly. But it happened, and they were able to get that rule passed. So we know that requiring a prescription for that drug does work. It takes it out of the lab. But requiring a prescription does have other complications with it. So. The new information that came to light was not available at the board for their permanent rulemaking effort. I don't know what, maybe a month ago or 2 months ago, there was a rumor that we heard that the lab was in St. Helens was taken down, and they did find liquid or gel cap pseudoephedrine. So the board asked me to do some research and find out what was really going on. And talking with Craig Durbin and Rob Babette both, we knew what had happened in St. Helens. The board sent me to a conference in Savannah, Georgia. It was the 14th annual DEA conference on diversion of controlled drugs and illicit chemicals. And among the things we talked about at that conference, I met one of the chemists from the DEA, and he described what the research they had done in the last couple months. And I asked him to document that, if you would. And that's one of the handouts that I passed around for you. That's the DEA's report to us directly that says that the liquid and gel cap products are easily converted, and as soon as they find that out, they're going to be using them, and that the reason they weren't using them is that nobody ever told them they could. They're creatures of habit, and
Mr.
they use
Schnabel,
the same.
Could you speak up a little bit? Thank you.
I'm sorry. So the board used this letter and the information from the DEA's conference. They used the information that Rob Babette provided, that was a similar report from the DEA. And for the board's small part, what they did was direct the staff to develop some language to bring back to them for consideration for rulemaking that would remove the exemption that they put in their permanent rule that allowed liquid and gel cap products to stay in the convenience stores. So they want to consider adopting a rule that would put everything behind the pharmacy counter.
And how long would that process take if they decided to go that route? How long would it take?
Normal rulemaking would probably take in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 months. If it was raised to the level of an emergency, to do it by temporary emergency rulemaking, they could do it next week.
And what do you say to the people who you know, from a pharmacy standpoint, from a medication standpoint, you know, it's pseudoephedrine or nothing. Nothing else works for my allergies. Have you looked into the alternatives? Are they effective?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that think it's the next point on my outline.
Okay,
here, as a matter of fact.
Okay, well, I'll just quit interrupting then here.
No, I appreciate the question because it is an important subject. And Blake Rice himself, in the absence of research that we didn't have at this point, took it upon himself to call two separate physicians who were allergy specialists, one in the southern part of the state and one in the central part of the state near Bend, and posed that question. And these are the people who treat allergy symptoms and would be, you know, the most likely to use those products. And they both agreed that the phenylephrine product is equally effective with pseudoephedrine, and they both agreed that it has a safer side effect profile. I mean, it escapes me why products using phenylephrine have not appeared before now. You know, I don't know the competition in the drug market and what happens out there. But
and just to clear this up, you said that the doctors told you that they have fewer side effects, these alternatives?
That phenylephrine has fewer side effects than pseudoephedrine. Okay. They also said that there are some patients who would do better on pseudoephedrine for a variety of reasons, and they estimated maybe 1 in 10, probably around 10% or less, might do better with pseudoephedrine. So a total ban is not the board's first choice, the Board of Pharmacy's first choice for that reason. But having it available by prescription, and I'd like to go over Blake's statement, which is the Board of Pharmacy statement. But at this point, other options do exist besides what the board could do or plans to do by rule, and that would be to make this drug pseudoephedrine prescription only. It would be as I think 2485 does, make pseudoephedrine a Schedule II controlled substance. The board could, if that happened, the board has authority to move drugs around in the schedule of controlled substances, so they could move it down to a Schedule III or a Schedule IV controlled substance. And any of those options would probably accomplish taking that precursor out of the local labs. So there would be other reasons to choose which of the options would be better. But I think any of those options would take the drug out of the labs. At this point, the board understands that legislation could be imminent through this committee and has not made a decision about what it would do beyond having language ready to go for a rule. If you would allow me to just read this brief statement, it is the
we
board's
position.
We have
it in front of us. If you could summarize it, that'd be great.
But basically, the board does not support a ban completely because there could be patients who would do better and by prescription with medical supervision would probably be appropriate to use. The board believes that requiring a prescription is the preferred way to go. Whether that needs to be a controlled substance or not, the board would defer that to your direction. If it was a controlled substance, it would require a prescription.
But the bottom line is, in light of the evidence, you agree with the previous speakers that they all ought to be treated the same, the tablets, the gel caps.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. And I think that's the main message that the board wanted to put out yesterday, is that they all ought to be treated the same, whether it's prescription, whether they're behind the counter. Take away the exemptions for liquid and gel cap products.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schnabel, I'm glad to hear you say that, because when I heard that the proposal was to ban all these products from the state, I thought that was pretty darned extreme, because there are people who use these products who have severe allergies and find they're appropriate.
I didn't follow your commentary, though, about the schedule, having it be a Schedule 2 and moving it around to a Schedule 3 and a Schedule 4. I mean, if you schedule it as one drug, how can you move it around to be a different schedule? So could you back up and explain that a little more carefully, please?
Sure, Madam Chair. Senator Walker, it is confusing unless you work with it every day like pharmacists do. Controlled substances exist in five different schedules, or there are five different levels or schedules of controlled substances, and that's based on assessment by the DEA of their abuse potential and potential for health risk. Schedule 5 is the lowest, least restrictive schedule. Schedule 1 is the most restrictive. Schedule 1 says there is no medical use for this drug and it cannot be prescribed, like heroin is an example.
Oh.
So it is a controlled substance, Schedule 1, and it's not legally prescribed by medical practitioners. Schedule 2 is the most restrictive that is available by prescription. Examples are morphine, Dilaudid, Demerol, pain drugs that you would see in a hospital. There is one methamphetamine product on the market that's used for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It is a Schedule 2 controlled substance. Schedule 3 is the next least restrictive. That is the less abused pain narcotics like Tylenol with codeine, Vicodin, that group. Then Schedule 4, mainly the tranquilizers like Valium and Xanax and benzodiazepine groups. That's generally the controlled substance. Schedule 5 then is sort of a special group that the DEA has where the state can decide if they even want to require a prescription or not. So you could have a Schedule 5 controlled substance that could be available from the pharmacy without a prescription. In that case, there are record keeping requirements that the DEA has for the pharmacist.
And what schedule, Senator Walker, can I follow up your question? What schedule were you contemplating for the pseudoephedrine?
Well, and I guess what made it confusing is that the board didn't make a decision, and I was trying to show you the three. It would be either 2, 3, or 4. And Schedule 2 is what I think is in the existing 2485. Page 9, I don't know which section it is, but it would remove, currently under the Board of Pharmacy's rule, which is the schedule of controlled substances under the state's Uniform Controlled Substance Act, ephedrine and pseudoephedrine are currently Schedule 2 controlled substances, but there is an exemption is written which allows ephedrine or pseudoephedrine products under that comply with FDA requirements and are available over the counter are exempt from that Schedule 2 rating. So the current language in 2485 would remove that exemption, which then would make ephedrine and pseudoephedrine Schedule 2 controlled substances. That would mean they need a prescription. It had to be a written prescription by a practitioner. It could not be refilled like a Schedule 3 or a Schedule 4 prescription. A Schedule 3 or 4 prescription doesn't need to be a written prescription. It could be called in by the physician, and it can be refilled for a period of time. It's just a different restriction.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Yeah, I had another one. Thank you, Madam Chair. What was the drug Rush Limbaugh was addicted to?
OxyContin.
And that's a Schedule what?
It's a Schedule 2.
Interesting. And Vicodin is one of the most popular street drugs right now, and that's a Schedule 3?
That's another one with an exemption. It is a Schedule 2 controlled substance, but combination products, including acetaminophen or aspirin, under FDA labeling guidelines, are Schedule 3. With certain amounts. Vicodin has 5 milligrams or 7.5 or 10 milligrams. In doses of that size in combination, they can be a Schedule 3. But the substance itself is a Schedule 2.
Okay, because that concerns me. if you put pseudoephedrine as a Schedule 3, because if Vicodin's out there on the street all the time, and I know from my work that it is out there a lot, if you put pseudoephedrine in the same class, it's going to be easily obtainable that way. So I guess I would recommend, if you're going to use it, to do a Schedule 2 and then require the written prescription. And I know that sometimes is a very difficult thing, because my son was in a serious accident a year ago and was left the hospital with morphine. And when he needed more of it, I had to go down to the doctor's office and get the handwritten prescription because they wouldn't refill it by phone. And that's true with a Schedule 2, correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. It's a double-edged sword. You know, it's better controlled, but it's a little more difficult to get your hands on.
So if you run out after hours, you're in a lot of trouble. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Any more questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Almost as I'm reading your, this email you got, I'm kind of reminded of the virus updates we have to do on our computer, where we're inoculating our computer against one virus, and then we have to do it again and again and again. And I, just looking back, 1970s, we used what they refer to as P2P. Then we moved to ephedrine, then to pseudoephedrine. And I'm just wondering, when are they going to start making their own ephedrine or going on to phenylephrine, which is now going to be apparently the substitute for pseudoephedrine?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's the game that's played, you know, and the chemists at DEA, the chemists at the Oregon Crime Lab just try to keep up. I mean, there's only so many, if you have a molecule, if you have a methamphetamine, you know, or a compound, there's only so many ways you can get there. Once you run out of those, then there are ways you can get to each one of those precursors. The farther back you go from that original chemical, the more difficult it is to get there. Right. This is Linda Howery. She is the current Board of Pharmacy President. She was elected after Blake Rice. She didn't prepare testimony and was only here to keep an eye on me. But if you want to hear from her, she's the current Board President. She reminded me, which I didn't say, is that phenylephrine cannot be converted. It cannot be made into a controlled substance.
Good, thank you.
It cannot be.
But
what?
The game, it cannot be converted into methamphetamine.
That's what they said about gel caps 6 months ago.
Yeah. Well, the chemists try to keep up, and every time they find a lab, they find a new chemical, it goes to the lab, and they're always one step behind. There probably will be other attempts, and we just try to keep up.
We probably need to move along. Are there questions before we... Thank you very much. Nancy Miller?
And company.
We didn't invite you, Mr. Prince.
Yeah.
I didn't call your name. It's not written here.
Madam Chair, Mr. Prince, please join me.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator with the Oregon Judicial Department. And first, like everyone else, I wanted to, on behalf of the Judicial Department, thank the Meth Task Force and this committee and the work group for all of the work that you've done working on this very difficult issue. I would like to particularly thank you for your acknowledgement and your affirmation of the excellent work of the committed and passionate drug court judges and drug court teams across our state. As you heard from Judge Larson last night, Oregon is a leader in the drug court movement. The second drug court in the country was started right in Multnomah County about 15 years ago. And as Judge Larson said, he has been beating this drum for 10 years. We are very excited that we have the opportunity to look at taking this exciting program to the next level. What you may not be aware of is that the Judicial Department had a 6-year plan to expand drug courts that was derailed by the catastrophic budget cuts in the 2001-2003 biennium. We've been here before, just like Judge Larson, beating this drum, and we're here again. These programs work. As you've heard from everyone, the recidivism rate is a statewide performance measure for the Judicial Department as it relates to drug court clients. We have a 90% success rate for graduates in terms of felony charges or misdemeanor charges 1 year after graduation from a drug court program. There are other statistics that are even more impressive, but due to your long list of people, I will spare you. I come to you today with a letter from the Chief Justice in regard to the drug court funding that Mr. Prince said he would help me articulate for you, and it's very brief, so I'd like to just read the letter to you. It says, as you move forward with your important legislation relating to the methamphetamine crisis in Oregon, I respectfully request that you consider action taken yesterday in both the Senate and House Budget Committees. The Chief Justice's budget includes a policy package to fund four existing drug courts whose federal funding is expiring. The package requests $942,679 in general fund and 7.75 FTE to save these currently existing drug court programs in Multnomah, Marion, Benton, and Malheur counties. You heard Mark McDonald from the District Attorney's Office in Portland testify last night that we've lost one drug court program in Multnomah. We are about to lose the second. The Judicial Department understands you're considering funding drug courts through a grant process within the Criminal Justice Commission, appropriating approximately $5 million to this effort. The Senate and House Budget Committees received reports and recommendations from the Legislative Fiscal Office recommending consideration be given to funding the existing drug court positions through your methamphetamine package. While the department would be happy to work with the Criminal Justice Commission to apply for expansion grants for new drug courts, time is of the essence to save our current programs. So the department is respectfully requesting that $942,679 and 7.75 FTE be funded directly in the department's budget to ensure that these excellent and proven programs can continue without interruption. Thank you for your consideration. Yours sincerely, Wallace P. Carson, Jr., Chief Justice. So that is our first request, Mr. Chair.
Is that his signature?
Yes, sir, it is.
Thank you.
You have the original, do you not, with his fountain pen?
I guess that's what it is.
Yes, sir.
I'll give him a bad time later.
Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Thank you. Curious to know where the Monterey number came from. There's no numbers in any of these drafts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, rumor.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Ms. Miller, let me ask you a question. You're here asking for money for drug courts, which has been a proven method of dealing with people who are addicted to methamphetamine. We got a letter introduced to this committee last night from Ron Sexton. I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but his opinion is that we should implement Measure 11 for these people convicted of these crimes. How much does it cost the state of Oregon to put someone in jail under Measure 11? Since we have a lot of people addicted to methamphetamine, that would be quite a few people we'd be putting in prison, would it not?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I assume it would.
And Mr. Chair, may I follow that up?
Follow up.
Thank you. And we find that putting them in drug court actually gets them off the drug and back out in society being productive citizens, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the research is clear that that's the case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
I've also been interested in drug courts. I observed one of the Marion County drug courts with Judge Graves. Very impressed. I loved it. And I heard that the federal money is drying up and that they're only taking people who could pay for it themselves. And it's my impression, listening to what the whole thrust of this is, to get them to be productive citizens. Has there been any thought to maybe they can't afford it now, but they're on their way to being productive citizens and having them pay into this program for the next person coming up and perpetuating itself that way? Has there been any thought towards that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, funny you should ask because I just talked to Judge Larson about that last night. And what he said was that he actually believes that it's extremely important to require people who can pay some costs of the program to do that as they progress further along, because he frames it in terms of being able to give back a little bit of what the system gave to you. And last session, we introduced, and this body passed, our drug court enabling legislation that does allow the court to charge fees. So that does happen when people have an ability to pay. And I'm wondering if Mr. Prinz wanted to say something about this piece before I talk about quick amendments to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I just wanted to say the issue is how quickly these federal grants, I think they're ending in July, and I don't know that we'll be out of session by then, and then I'd have to I don't have staff to do if the plan, which I think is, you know, we're going forward with, which is a good plan, is to have the CJC to do the grant administering. I hope that was for new systems, new populations served either in the communities that already have drug courts or in the counties that don't, that want to have them. Those would be grants for those. And my concern is that I would not be able to even have, you know, there wouldn't be a system up and running by the time that the federal drug court grants are gone. That being said, I'm hopeful that whatever we do, that's new information, and that goes in the judicial department for the current ones, and I hope that we can get as much money possible for the appropriations to the grants. And I'm also hopeful that when we look to the federal government, it's my understanding when I talk to them, these grants are going away, but they are looking at having new grants for drug courts. I think this is a national move, and so I'm hoping that we can, these that have existing grants, yes, these grants are going away, but I think in the future I'm hopeful that all these drug courts will have new ones that we can work together to try to bring federal money into as well. But for now, I think it's prudent to try to keep the funding for the ones we already have. They are the success stories that we've been basing a lot of this on, and it would seem foolish to stop them kind of midstream.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a couple of comments about the bills. In House Bill 2485, in the section that on page, whoops, wrong one, on page 23 of the bill, we are working with Mr. Prinz around the language for the grants to the Criminal Justice Commission and Ms. Moed, and we are respectfully suggesting some simpler language that then could be fleshed out by rules developed by the Criminal Justice Commission. A couple of the concerns that we have about the current language, and I've shared this with counsel and with Mr. Prinz, the local public safety coordinating councils really focus on criminal processes, if you will. We have juvenile dependency drug courts. We have juvenile delinquency drug courts, all of which are very effective. And we want to make sure that the grant process is broad enough for the commission to at least consider grants from those drug courts as well. So we've provided Ms. Moed with some language, and we'll continue to work with her and hope the committee will consider that when it comes back. And then very briefly on Senate Bill 907 on page 13 of the bill in subsection 12, where it says, this is the part that talks about a court modifying parenting time if a parent is abusing substances. It says on line 18, if the court finds that the parent has abused controlled substances, with an S, you probably only want one controlled substance to be good enough. So we are suggesting that you delete the S. And unfortunately, we have to look at these bills in terms of arguments that we anticipate might be made by both sides, and with a plural on there, you might have to abuse two before you can have your parenting time curtailed. The other recommendation in that section has to do with the beginning of the sentence where it says the court may suspend or terminate a parent's parenting time. We would suggest that the language, in addition to other orders a court may make with regard to parenting time, and I'll give this to Ms. Moed, a court may suspend or terminate, because you don't want to limit the court's option to only suspend or terminate. So those are our recommendations, and again, on behalf of the Chief Justice, thank you for all the work that you have done on this important issue.
Committee members, Governor Claus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either of you who commented last night we did hear testimony about the benefit of the asset forfeiture piece that's moving through and the funds that would flow from that to help support and sustain the drug courts. Do either of you have any comments either way?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, I do not know exactly what the provisions of that bill will bring to the drug courts, but I can tell you in general, any funding that is supporting the drug courts supports an effective program. In terms of whether or not asset forfeiture is a good idea, the Judicial Department would be neutral on that kind of a policy issue.
Mr. Chair, sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores.
Call me Ms.
Got switched up. I have looked at that legislation. I think in the bill it's either 10% or 20% of the money would go to drug courts. And I think we're supportive of that at the Criminal Justice Commission. I think it makes sense. And, of course, we're the we also serve as the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee. So very supportive of that. I think it makes sense policy-wise to do that.
And, Mr. Chair, one last comment, just if anyone's interested. This is the most recent evaluation we've done of the Benton County Drug Court, both the process evaluation and the outcome evaluation, which is still in draft. The statistics are amazingly impressive. When this is finalized, I'd be happy to provide it to members of the committee. Most of our drug courts have undergone evaluations, and we'd be happy to provide that information if anybody wants it.
How many pages would we have to read? Is there like a... boom, 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 this is what you get.
Is there an abridged version? We can, yes, we can do an 44 pages in this one.
Once you get it down to one or two.
One or two, I'm all over it.
That we really need to know.
I'll do it.
That helps because, you know, I get about 1,000 pages a day, and you know what happens to some of them.
I heard, Mr. Chair.
There's a couple of them I miss.
Thank you very much.
Senator Walker, did you have something?
No, I just agree with you. 1,000 pages a day, and a couple do get missed.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Have Paul Snyder and Kevin Mannix come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House and Judiciary Committees. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing this afternoon in conceptual support of the amendments to both House Bill 2485 and Senate Bill 907. The reason for the conceptual support is that we haven't gone all the way through the amendments yet, but as far as we've gone, they look very good to us, and we would just like to join the chorus of the witnesses who have already appeared to commend the committee for the work you've already done and the product that you've already put together. I'd like, though, in my testimony to bring you back to a point in time that was early in the session. That was when the Judiciary Committee staff and the Ways and Means Committee staff did a masterful job of putting together for you the Doug Harkle Road, Ross Shepherd relay team on the public safety system. One of the components that I got from that presentation is that the system is balanced, it's complex, and the balance within the system should be maintained. I think this bill does that. It's the three-legged stool that Rob Bouvette presented to you, and I think that's very commendable in terms of the comprehensive approach that it takes to dealing with a very difficult problem. And I'd like to thank you for not calling me up right after Rob finished those videos, because it would have been a tough act to follow. But with respect to that balance, it's got to be both substantive and resourceful. You recall last evening when Judge Larson testified, he talked about drug court as a system. And the piece of the system, obviously the critical component of that system, is the court itself. It creates the incentive and the hammer for the offender to develop the kind of attitude that it takes to get successfully treated. But another important aspect of that system is the treatment itself. If we don't have the treatment in place, then the offender's attitude doesn't make any difference. And an aspect of this, just going down the list of things that the bills do, I just noted the number of sections where it either creates a crime or modifies an existing crime in a way that expands the crime. All of these things are valuable tools, but they can only be implemented effectively if the resources are there to do it. So an important aspect of our testimony is to say thank you for the substantive work on this, and please help us to provide the resources that it takes to make the rest of this system work together.
Can you stay for us with a minute until we get all the questions at
yes,
the
I
end?
Can, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm here today as Citizen Mannix, not in any other capacity. And I've heard part of the testimony, and I've read a lot of the material that's been put together in regard to these two pieces of legislation. I'd like to give you a micro-analysis and a macro-analysis. The micro-analysis has to do with the challenges of the current session, the challenges of the current day, and the fact that these bills do in themselves integrate a variety of solutions, and they do move us forward. That's a good thing, and it's a very important thing. The macro analysis is, outside of this day and outside of this session, you have not been given the resources to do the job that needs to be done. This is not the D-Day landing in Europe for dealing with methamphetamine and all of the related issues. It's the raid at Dieppe. It's an incursion. It's a positive move in the right direction, but it is not the frontal assault. The frontal assault will come when we provide the resources for an integrated approach, and we take a look at public safety here as involving, yes, the victims, and yes, society, and how we holistically address this. And I will give you a few brief examples. Relief nurseries are an incredibly important component of helping to address the prevention issue in the community, and we should do all we can to take that successful model and fund it. Please consider that as a specific solution that is in front of you, that's available, that works, and the key there will be funding. If you move along down the pike and you talk about DHS and their capacity to help the children who have been victimized, the caseload for the caseworkers is incredible. It's about four times what it should be. Now, we don't have the cash resources today to hire four times the caseworkers, but I would suggest to you one creative incursion would be to say that we will no longer require that people who do the casework have a Bachelor of Science degree or a Bachelor of Arts degree, that we will suspend that for 2 years and allow caseworkers who are interns under those with the BA or BS degrees, people taken from schools, and fund some positions where they can take on part of the caseload. I would put it this way. They would have a Bachelor of Arts degree. People who can work with the families and the kids and at least temporarily be put out in the field. We have students who are working towards their degrees, and you could save money, and yes, you could hire interns. This solution didn't come from me. This solution came from me talking to Marion County people about how they used to have interns. They used to be able to work with students. They've lost the funding for that. There are some then cost-effective short-term ways you can then expand the caseload. But let me give you one dramatic example about how you can get more bang for the buck with one specific incursion. That's sort of a dam buster. I'm using World War II analogies. You blow the dam, they lose the power. There's tremendous things that happen in wartime. Here's your dam buster. Federal prosecution. I heard the dialogue last night with Senator Walker raising the question of deputy DAs being designated and affirmed as special assistant U.S. attorneys. Our DA's offices are so overwhelmed that they can't take the staff anymore to do that. What do you get when you get a special assistant U.S. attorney who happens to be a state-funded or county-funded DA? You get a free ride on indigent defense. You get a free ride on incarceration. You get a free ride on treatment while incarcerated. You get a free ride on everything that helps in terms of transition back into the community. What do you also get? You get an immediate opportunity to take the producers and the major distributors. I'm not talking here users. I'm talking about the people that are pressing this oppressive item on the community and get them off the streets. So I would respectfully suggest to you that you consider setting aside a decent amount of state funding that is designated to hire DAs, state-funded and designated counties, I would suggest 25 DAs, who are only to be used as special assistant U.S. attorneys, so they can prosecute cases in the federal courts, where the federal government then assumes the cost of defense, the federal government assumes the cost of incarceration and all the subsequent costs. That lets you send out a major issue that we're going to go after everyone out there that is manufacturing and dealing drugs. We'll put state resources into it. Now, there's some affiliated costs associated with this. DAs need investigators. They'll need some support staff. And I would just give you a round figure of $5 million as a starting point, which is a rough estimate of 25 deputy DAs at $100,000 per unit for 2 years. But I think that if you got that kind of specific appropriation with that kind of specific attack, that is one thing you can do to put a tourniquet on this wound. Stop the bleeding. We're not getting to the root causes with this, but we are for the short term intervening in a dramatic way that I think can make a big difference, because we can send a message that we are going to go after anybody who is manufacturing or selling illegal drugs, especially methamphetamine. So I lay that at your feet. I encourage you in your work, and I will not join in those critics who put the burden on you for coming up with all the solutions when you haven't been given the resources. Thank you.
Committee members, you have some questions, comments? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mannix, that's exactly why I brought that point up last night about using the federal government and special assistant prosecutors, because it takes them out of the state system and dumps them in the federal system, keeps our prison can't really accommodate too many more inmates. And it really takes partnership with the federal government to do that. So I really want to, I'm going to ask our folks here to try to work with the federal government to get more money to the states to help do that. If the federal government realizes we have a problem, which they soon will because meth is now on the East Coast, they're going to become more aggressive about that. But I agree that the cooks, the distributors, prosecute them under the federal law, and then we take everyone else and we work with them in drug courts and we do what we need to do.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I would urge you to not await federal funding. I would urge you to demand $5 million of general funds and point out that you're probably getting $50 million worth of impact. It's probably a 10-to-1 ratio if you look at the long-term cost of incarceration, treatment while incarcerated, the release programs, the cost of indigent defense. And respectfully, I'd suggest look for the federal grant money for other things, such as expanding the drug court program. And the federal government at some point will get a little nervous about the fact that they're helping fund a program where we then make them spend more of their money. So getting grants for that might also make them a little nervous when they see what we're doing. I'd rather have us just do it ourselves and use some of our general fund dollars looking for the multiplication factor. Thank you.
Senator Wissett, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. You know, this legislature has at our disposal $12.393 billion. That's, colleagues, that's $12,393 million. What possible priority could exceed addressing this methamphetamine scourge? This deadly epidemic is destroying our families, our communities, our whole social fabric. $5 million? You know, $50 million is 0.4% of that budget. I mean, what are we talking about here? We should address the specter that is at hand. This is a problem that has been in rural Oregon and other parts of rural America for a long time. We've discovered it now in Salem in the last couple of sessions, and it's moving across the United States, and we're told our site has been discovered in Boston now. Well, folks, it's been around for a long time, and we can tell you about methamphetamine for rural Oregon. I could not agree with Mr. Mannix more. We need to find the funds to do this, and it should be prioritized top line. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Yeah, go ahead, and then I'll get to Representative Barker in a second.
Mr. Chairman, I represent Senator Woodson.
Yes, and actually, my view of the appropriations process vis-a-vis the substantive process is that there's always some frustration here. Having served on judiciary, but also having served in ways and means on judiciary, you get to look at all the solutions substantively that you would move forward with, but you don't get the money. And then you go to ways and means, and you look at all the money, and you're kind of frustrated not knowing how to best prioritize the resources. Had you had a proposed budget that came to you that said, we intend to spend, say, $300 million across the board, everywhere from prevention to early intervention to accountability to treatment to reentry, and then say to the substantive committees, look at how you can best use those dollars and give you 5 months to work through the process, I think much more progress could have been made this session. However, you were not given that opportunity, and that is why I've come in humbly with a couple of suggestions about things you can do in addition to what's in this package legislation. Thank you.
Okay.
And I just was comment, it's been a few years, but in the past we'd have cases we thought for I was at local police in Portland, we thought the feds could do, and they could have, and they wouldn't take them. I mean, unless it was really, although pre-Major 11, I remember at one point they started taking bank robberies because nothing was happening on the state level to bank robbers, and so the feds finally stepped in on that. But I don't know how we're going to get them to go ahead and take those cases, even if we offer them a DA to run them.
Mr. Chairman? If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, the way it works, the reason the feds don't want to take cases is because they have their own resource issues in terms of staff in the U.S. Attorney's Office. There are just so many U.S. attorneys to handle cases. But if you hand them the prosecutor and you say, we've done the investigation, and you don't have to, and here's your special assistant U.S. attorney, you've taken care of the concern of the prosecutor's office. Now, the courts may not be happy, but they have to deal with their caseloads. Federal prisons may not be happy, but they've got to deal with the people who got the judgment of conviction and got sent to their front door. And the only people that need to be made happy are the U.S. attorneys and their associated folks, and our DAs are well-equipped to make them very happy if we provide them with the personnel and the case to do the job. And that's the difference here. We would be providing the personnel at the get-go.
Okay, thank you.
Just one other further comment. In rural Oregon, certainly in Klamath County, and I know in other counties, the district attorneys have been utilizing the federal resources for prosecution for some time for two reasons. One, they don't have the money to do it themselves without federal aid. And two, the federal laws are much more stringent, and you can actually put these people away and they don't come back. So, I mean, if you really are interested in, I believe, in finding out, you know, how to go about doing that, you should interview some rural district attorneys who have been doing it for a while.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
John Hummel. I'm going to let you come up alone, John, and then we can hammer at you. He knows I'm kidding you.
Chair Krieger, members of the Joint Committee, my name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney from Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA commends the Joint Committee for your effort to craft methamphetamine bills that strike a balance between our state's need to eliminate this destructive drug with our obligation to assist addicts and their families. Your efforts to address the concerns pointed out in our meth position paper that was distributed earlier this session have been noticed and are appreciated. Meth is our state's problem. It must be solved by everyone working together. That includes defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, police, treatment professionals, corrections officers, legislators, and all the residents of Oregon. Thank you for allowing us to have a seat at the table. OCDLA supports the bills as drafted. And let me repeat that. OCDLA supports the bills as drafted. These bills, as you are all aware, contain criminal sanctions that are more severe than the current sanctions. And if you want to see a Donnybrook, of all Donnybrooks, you should have been at the meeting of the legislative committee of the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys when we were deciding whether or not to support a bill that increased penalties. But we did support the bills because it's our state and these are our clients every day who we see in courts who are struggling to survive. Remember, we have a unique perspective on this problem. Our clients who are addicted to this drug know that they can talk to us about their problems in complete confidence, and they share some horrific stories. This is a problem. We know about it. We're willing to accept these bills with increased penalties because, on balance, they're bills that are going to help us solve this problem. We support the bills as drafted. There's a few suggestions we have for improvements. They're not that significant. I'll address those. In House Bill 2485, the section that creates the offense of possessing or disposing of meth waste, we recognize dumping of meth waste is terrible. It has awful environmental impacts. We support laws to punish the dumping of methamphetamine waste. However, this bill also criminalizes possession of meth precursor substance debris. And this could result in addicts who do not necessarily manufacture meth. They could be charged with possession of methamphetamine and the possession of meth waste if they have in their possession something like a blister pack that had been used, because under the definition, a used blister pack could be the preparation of a precursor substance. So we asked staff, and we would be willing to work with counsel to tighten up the possession of waste definition to apply only to the byproducts of the manufacturing process. The dumping definition should not change, because I don't care how benign the blister pack might be. If you dump it, you should be punished. So we would look for some clarification on that. On the food stamps, this is philosophical. I won't go long on this because it is a philosophical debate, and I know everyone here has strong feelings about it, but we feel it's inappropriate to deny food to a hungry and a needy person. Punishment and treatment are certainly appropriate if someone has committed theft or fraud involving food stamp benefits. Charge them with the crime, but starvation is not the appropriate penalty. If someone commits murder, we put them in prison, but we don't deny them food. They get three meals a day. It would be odd indeed to deny food to an addict who commits theft but give three hot meals a day to a murderer. And we don't support denying food for food stamp fraud. Drug courts work. They are more effective than prison in reducing recidivism. They save significant dollars for our state. We heard Multnomah. The Multnomah County Drug Court study cited by Judge Larson, the savings is over $5,000 per person as compared to traditional punishment. They save families and they save lives. I've worked in drug courts for about 5 years in Cook County and have seen clients, and I know names now which I won't share, but they would be dead if not for drug court, and they're alive now and they're productive members of society. And I will say that from the mountaintop for as long as I live. They work. We support the provisions of the bill that provide for the expansion of drug courts around our state. However, we are concerned that with the pressures on our general fund, drug courts will not receive the funding they need. We encourage the Joint Committee to identify a funding source for these worthy and cost savings programs. I've identified one. There's numerous others. I think Senator Whitsitt, though, hit the nail on the head. Now, I could tell you my 10 or 20 favorite. If we want to do it, we do it. And it's a high priority, and I would encourage the Joint Committee to do it. In Senate Bill 907, the criminal mistreatment section, there are two ways that a person can commit this offense. The first is by permitting a dependent or elderly person to be on premises where a chemical reaction involving one or more precursor substances is occurring. That's most appropriate. If you're cooking, there's chemical reaction, you have a child on site, we need to punish that. The other way you can commit that offense is by permitting a dependent or elderly person to be on premises where the preparation of a precursor substance is occurring. This could result in the enhanced penalty for having a used cold blister pack in the house where a child is located. That doesn't necessarily endanger the child. we would ask for the definition to be tightened so we're focusing on the conduct that we want to focus on. And again, I'll offer my services to provide language later. Council, Moad, yes?
Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
A point was brought up, not in testimony last night, but sort of off the record, and I know, and I've talked to Ms. Sky as well about the preparation of precursor substance potentially having unintended consequences, and I think we can shore that up. The issue that was brought up to me, and I'm just curious to get your position on it now so that when the work group is discussing it, we know your position, is with that mistreatment / child neglect piece. The idea that we had in mind, of course, was the toxicity of the meth lab, which I think you were in Pendleton with us as well and saw Sergeant Gearhart's presentation regarding that the toxicity stays in a home where methamphetamine has been produced until it is cleaned out. I mean, it's not something that dissipates over time. And I'm curious if we clarified that precursor substance issue, but if we added a piece that said or knowingly allows a child to remain in a home where the parent or guardian knew methamphetamine had been manufactured and knew the home had not been cleaned out, what do you guess OCDLA's position on that would be?
Council Moad, that would be an appropriate crafting of the language. We recognize that when these chemicals are combined in a home, it creates toxins that stay around the home for quite some time. That's wrong to expose kids to that, and it should be a crime. We're just concerned with what I said before. If someone is not producing the chemicals, they might get caught up in this. So we would support that language.
Thank you.
And the last thing I'd like to touch on is the enhanced incarceration issues that we heard the Oregon District Attorneys Association mentioned. Let me begin by saying we do support enhanced penalties, the enhanced penalties that are in the bill. We don't support the enhanced plus penalties that we heard testimony about last night. There are situations when incarceration is appropriate, and sometimes that incarceration should include prison time. What situations warrant prison? How long should the prison terms be? What is the funding source for the added expense of those prison beds? We might never all agree to those answers, but suffice it to say, the answers are not self-evident. They require study, analysis, and much thought. And no one in this room has worked harder to answer those questions than the members of the meth work group. The Oregon District Attorneys Association has asked this committee to amend Senate Bill 907 so that a person convicted of manufacturing meth for the first time would serve a 19-month prison sentence. Now, unlike the empirical evidence that was presented to support the effectiveness of drug courts, the Oregon District Attorneys Association has presented no evidence to support their position that such a change would be good for Oregon. They have also not identified a funding source to pay for the cost of these beds. There are four points to remember, and these are the four points that I'm going to close with. Four points to remember when considering prison sentences for first-time manufacturing convictions. First, most Oregon meth manufacturers are addicts. Unlike the Mexican drug cartels or the few large-scale Oregon manufacturers for whom the manufacturing of meth is a business, Oregon labs exist to produce meth for personal use. If you stop the addiction, you stop the manufacturing. If you do not stop the addiction, there will still be a market for the Mexican cartels. Now, that having been said, regardless of whether you're an addict, if you produce a large quantity of meth, that shows that you're producing it for more than yourself, for more than your addiction. You're producing it for someone else. Senate Bill 907 recognizes the philosophies I've just talked about. If you produce a large quantity, the first time, you're gone. If you're producing it for yourself and you're an addict, we're going to try to kick your addiction. If we're not successful kicking your addiction and you produce a small quantity a second time, then you're hammered. We think that's a good proposal. Second, the punishment cited by the District Attorneys Association for first-time meth convictions, it's only a minimum sentence that we heard about. If certain aggravating factors exist, any guidelines minimum sentence can be twice as long as the guideline sentence, certain aggravating factors would have to be proven, and as we heard with the Blakely bill, there would be an option for it to be proven to a jury now. But if those certain aggravating factors exist, that this is more than just the run-of-the-mill meth cooking lab, sentence can be double the grid block sentence. Third, an Oregon methamphetamine manufacturing conviction does not necessarily mean you made methamphetamine. If this is a legal technicality. If a meth addict has a bag of meth in their house for their personal use, let's say they have it in a bag, they remove half of it, put it in another bag. Maybe they feel their roommate might steal their stash or something. They want to put it in their sock drawer away from their roommate, so they put it in another bag. They have just committed the crime of manufacturing methamphetamine. Oregon law says if you repackage methamphetamine, that constitutes manufacturing. Now, it would be unjust, I suggest, respectfully, and a tremendous waste of resources to punish a first-time addict for repackaging meth to a term of 19 months in prison. And the fourth point. We have an aid and abet theory in Oregon, which means you can be convicted for an underlying crime even if you're not the principal actor. And this does happen occasionally with methamphetamine convictions. Far too often we see a vulnerable cohort, often a woman, perhaps an abused woman who's the girlfriend. Boyfriend is making meth for he and his friends. Perhaps even the girlfriend it uses sometimes. She's caught up in a terrible situation, and maybe she provides assistance of some sort. Maybe she looks out the window. He says, tell me if the police are coming. I'm going to cook something in the shed. And she looks out the window. She's scared of him. She's an addict. She looks out the window. Or some other situation where she helps him. She can be convicted of manufacturing methamphetamine under a theory that she aided or abetted her boyfriend who was manufacturing. To send that addict away for 19 months on a first-time offense, I respectfully suggest would be unjust. So in conclusion, if OCDLA drafted these bills, if I was dictator and drafted these bills, you know what? They would have looked different. They wouldn't have had the increased penalties that they do have. Conversely, I suggest if the Oregon District Attorney's Association drafted the bills, I suggest the enhanced prison penalties would have been significantly greater. These bills in front of you strike a balance, and they reflect an appropriate compromise. We urge your support for the bills as drafted with the relatively minor changes we have suggested. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hummel. With respect to that point about repackaging and packaging, at least for some purpose, as I recall, the draft bill makes a change. That was identified as an issue in the the work group that developed these proposals. Maybe I could invite counsel to comment on that. What respect did we pull out the packaging and repackaging element of the manufacturing definition?
Representative McPherson and members of the committees, we directed the Criminal Justice Commission to elevate manufacturing to a level 6 on the sentencing guidelines only if it involved that chemical reaction or preparation of controlled substances, but not if that packaging, repackaging, labeling, relabeling piece occurred. In re-reviewing the repeat offender sentences, it is not, and I frankly don't remember what the work group decided on this particular issue, was whether the level 4 manufacturer and the level 6 manufacturer would be subject to that repeat offender. It's not clear in the current draft, and I think the work group needs to revisit that issue. But in any event, certainly the elevation to the level 6 is only the cooks, not that packaging, repackaging piece.
Okay, well, thank you. We appreciate your raising that and the very constructive role that the OCDLA plays in the giving us input on this package of legislation. Are there any questions for Mr. Hummel? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hummel, in regard to your position, your comment on the food stamp piece, inappropriate to deny food to hungry people. You do say that punishment and treatment are certainly appropriate for someone who has committed theft or fraud involving food stamps. We do hear in the media that the use of food stamps or in Oregon Trail card for the use, purchase, and barter of meth is significant and it's a problem. And these folks, number one, they may not be eating, and they're certainly not feeding their children. So where is the punishment? How would you deal with that? I mean, you're suggesting basically to take a pass on that from what way I understand you.
Thank you, Representative Flores. It's a challenge. Let me begin with that. I certainly understand the struggles of this committee, and I don't feel that anyone on this committee is enjoying coming forth with a proposal suggesting that we might do this. But I would respectfully disagree on our position as taking a pass. If somebody commits theft, they should be charged with theft and prosecuted for theft and should suffer the appropriate penalties, be it jail time or probation or, you know, the myriad other penalties that you achieve as a result of a criminal conviction. We don't say there should be a pass. If they commit theft for involving food stamps or an Oregon Trail card, they should be charged with a crime. We think, though, that the food should not be denied to them.
Follow up?
Yeah, you may.
Thank you. And I understand that, and I think we agree, but I'm just concerned about how we really do address the problem when we, it's clear and it's evident that these benefits are being used in this illicit activity. These people are not taking care of themselves, they're not taking care of their families, they're certainly not taking care of their children.
Okay.
Isn't there a way to come to address that?
Representative Flores, I realize I'm going to give this up here and my membership might not be too happy about it, but I have been brainstorming with some people on this issue, and I think we could attack this problem on the other end. If an addict is buying drugs with their food stamps or Oregon Trail card, perhaps we could enhance the punishments for dealers who are discovered to have these Oregon Trail cards in their possession. When the police say they go out and they arrest people who have a bunch of Oregon Trail cards in their possession, those are the people who sold the drugs in exchange for the Oregon Trail cards. So rather than removing food benefits from the addict, we can maybe go after the dealers who are accepting Oregon Trail cards as payment for their drugs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some similar questions along those lines regards to food stamps. And you mentioned that you working with your clients who have had meth exposure. Tell me how many, I would imagine that a lot of these folks lose their kids or at least temporarily. So when you look at the high rate of use by women, first of all, because this is drug in particular, but yet the very low access to treatment by these meth users overall. It seems to me like if I was a meth addicted woman and I had kids, that's the last place I'd go is to seek treatment because I know my kids are going to get taken away. So how big of a fear is that? How big of a reality is that?
Thank you for that question. As I think you're well aware, methamphetamine is a drug that is making inroads into the female population at a quicker rate than any drug we've ever seen, and it does have an impact disproportionately on children as a result of the fact that there's so many single mothers in the state. I have seen many of my clients who are females with kids, and I can tell you this, they don't care about anything else in the world when they're on methamphetamine, but one thing can bring a tear to their eye, and that's when you mention to them that they could lose their kids. And in the throes of their addiction, their heart still swells, and they will break down. Finding a way to encourage them to get the help they need while satisfying them in their heart that if they do what they need to do, they can keep their kids, That's the greatest challenge. There's a great program in Baker City that lets women take their children with them to the treatment program, and they live there for up to a year. And it's a wonderful treatment program. There's not enough beds to treat everyone who needs it, but you know, I hate to be beating the drum here because I understand the pressures on the general fund, but if we had more residential treatment beds for women and with children, that would go a long way to solving it, but it costs money.
Follow-up?
You may.
Well, that's exactly what I was trying to think of. Is there, are there better ways? It seems like we've got this data in our possession that this drug is addictive to women 2-to-1 opposed to any other drug, and that the highest rate of increase amongst users are women, girls under 17. So it seems like we've got this data, but what we're doing with it is not using it to funnel resources to help these users. We're using it in a punitive way. When you look at the food stamp benefits, I mean, 93% of welfare recipients are single mothers in Oregon. So disproportionately, those are people who are going to get hurt by the food stamp provision in these bills. And then the increase of, you know, the criminality of mistreatment and neglect and getting your children taken away from you. So it seems like we're using that known factor that this population is in desperate need of help that we're targeting. So tell me what's the potential cost savings of all the of the TANF, taking the TANF and the food stamps away from these users and the increased of all the criminal mistreatment neglected. What's the total cost savings of that? You know, how much is that going to save of our problem? And couldn't we then use that kind of money to do something more preventative, like the program that you're suggesting, or parents mothering classes or parents-child classes while they're incarcerated that they would have to go through and then have a better chance of getting their children back? Because we don't have enough foster care either to take care of all these kids.
Thank you for that, Representative Worth. It's a complex problem to get your arms around. I've heard you talk about a lot there. I think what's very important to remember, and I heard you say that we seem to be funneling a disproportionate amount of this money toward punitive aspects. To incarceration, perhaps, is what you meant.
Okay, I'm sorry. What I'm saying is that what we're doing with the knowledge that it's women and younger women. We're not using our resources to help them, mm-hmm. you know, in a demand sort of way. We're going after in a punitive way.
Thank you, Representative Worth. What I've found, and I think everyone who's worked extensively in the court system, is with a methamphetamine addiction, all the other good things that need to be done to have this person be a successful member of society cannot be done until you first get a handle on the addiction. The parenting classes are very important than every other class to help a mother be able to get employment skills. But what has to come first is the addiction treatment. And that's why drug courts are most effective, because they utilize a punitive nature, some early jail and some jail throughout the process to really, you know, make you committed to get clean. And then once you get clean, at the end of drug court, you'll often see it expand from just the addiction treatment to the parenting classes and the job training and the other classes such as that. So again, I'm beating a drum here over and over, but I think it's the answer to most of the questions. Drug courts do work.
Final question, Mr. Chair. I'm fortunate in Benton County to have a wonderful drug court, and I've been there and watched it work, and I can agree with you more. But I'm wondering what are there more women in drug court than there are men, or is there just, because I'm wondering, are we looking at what type of impediment is that for women to seek treatment knowing that their kids are going to be taken away, and after we pass this bill, even more so. And I just think that that's an impediment we're not looking at. And if there's possibility of getting them into drug court, then let's by all means not say, you could go to drug court, you get clean, but, you know, you're going to
I'm wondering if there's a question there, or whether we need to, is there something that we need to get?
If they know if the impediment, what degree it is.
Representative Worth, I can tell you this. If the judge orders a mother to go to prison, well, obviously she won't be raising her kid, so she'll lose her kid. If a judge orders a mother to go on probation and she's not supervised closely and gets back into drug use, DHS is most likely going to take that child. If a judge orders a mother into drug court and she's doing very well in drug court, I found DHS to be quite willing to work with that mother to allow the mother to have her child back, because DHS knows that drug court is more intense supervision than DHS can even provide. 3 to 4 drug tests a day, 3 to 4 drug counseling classes a week, usually 4 to 5 AA meetings a week, and group counseling. So DHS is willing to let mothers keep their children who are in drug court if they're doing well in drug court.
Yes, thank you.
Are there any more questions for Mr. Hummel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to take Representative Chip Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, particularly for seeing me on such short notice. I've got to get to another meeting at 4 o'clock. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, and I am also the founder and former executive director of Better People, an employment and counseling organization for people who are in recovery from addiction and people who've been in trouble with the law. I hold a master's in social work from Portland State University, and my graduate studies focused on drug and alcohol treatment and young offender prisoner reentry. I'm here in support of the package. I think this is a very good package generally, but there are just 3 additional points I would like to make on it. The first one is one that I think Mr. Hummel was touching on, is that very often meth cooks are meth addicts, and meth addicts are meth cooks. The second point I'd like to make is that this effort will require a significant infusion of funding for treatment resources, particularly in rural areas. And then the third point is that addicts and criminals generally don't make decisions like normal, ordinary, responsible people. On the first point, Dr. Richard Rawson, who many of you have heard talk on this topic, agreed with me that there's a very blurry line between who is a cook and who is just an addict. And my concern is that some of the longer prison sentences in this bill, and particularly the longer sentences suggested in testimony last night, may take us down the road to simply locking up more addicts and letting them out with no treatment, only to see them return again and again. In essence, longer sentences, particularly without resources for treatment, will take us down the road to repeating the mistakes of the crack epidemic when legislators like us talk tough about locking up drug kingpins, but what we locked up most, however, were lower-level dealers and addicts. And the point is that treatment, alternative incarceration programs, and properly supervised probation is probably just as important for cooks as for those in possession of methamphetamine. The second issue is treatment. I wanted to suggest that for this effort to be successful, we must be sure that the bills include resources necessary for treatment success. This will require the infusion for community-based treatment, particularly in the rural areas of the state that do not have inpatient community-based drug and alcohol treatment. Now, one of the reasons why the Multnomah County Stop Drug Court is successful is because there's a full range of treatment resources in Portland area, from outpatient to community-based inpatient treatment. And we need those type of treatment resources statewide. And while drug courts are important to turning around the lower-risk addicts, particularly who are self-correcting, another part of the literature suggests that treatment of offenders is most effective when it is targeted on high-risk offenders. Now, the last point I wanted to make is this: meth cooks, meth addicts, and criminals don't make decisions like normal, ordinary, responsible people. Rarely do they weigh what the potential outcome of their actions are going to be. So we should just keep that in mind, that it is unlikely they will weigh whether their behavior is a level 4 or a level 6 offense according to the sentencing guidelines. They will just do it. And they, and eventually us as taxpayers, will simply pay the price. We should therefore, in my view, target jail and prison time towards hassling people enough that they'll enroll in treatment and eventually complete it. As one of my clients at Volunteers of America Men's Residential Center said, "Hey, I just came here to get out of jail. I had no interest in getting clean, but you know, recovery just kind of happened." And
And if the resources for treatment are there, particularly in the rural parts of the state, sometimes recovery just happens. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee? Thank you very much. Andrea Meyer.
Chairs Burdick and Krieger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Just for the record, so to speak, the concerns and issues raised by the OCDA are, of course, in this case, shared by the ACLU. I'm going to just target two other areas that have probably not been discussed that are ACLU concerns. On House Bill 2485, page 9 talks about the State Board of Pharmacy requirement of databasing the information of purchasers in retail sales of the liquid-filled gelatin capsules or liquid preparations. I have testified not only this session but in the past about in other committees about our very serious concerns about the power of databasing and creating databases on the lawful activities of Oregonians. We have seen in the last year, just 2005, numerous stories in the paper about the accidental release of very personal information, the stealing of personal information that has been accumulated by the uses of databases. And I mean, I'm talking driver's license information, Social Security, you've heard about it, LexisNexis and some other banks and others. Despite their best attempts, and many of them have very serious provisions in their policies to ensure that this information is kept confidential and protected, it gets people hack into it or it gets stolen in some other ways. In this case, what we're potentially looking at is tens of thousands of Oregonians who buy lawful cough medicines. And, you know, our grave concern is both how this information can be used by someone and who will have access to it. Now, we have no objections to making it more difficult to purchase these items. And we certainly support the concerns that this committee has and this state has about taking these materials out of the hands of meth dealers. But we're giving broad authority to the Board of Pharmacy to create a database that not only can be used for law enforcement for potentially, I'm not sure how they would use it. It's collecting all sorts of information at the front end, and I assume driver's license information, so that you can actually know the identity of the person and sufficient enough that John Smith isn't just John Smith, but some particular information to identify which John Smith it is. And then I'm not sure what law enforcement's going to do, say, to the retail outlet provide these lists and now we're going to start checking and we're going to knock on your door, excuse me, why have you bought this and the quantity? So we're going to take drivers out. What kind of personal information we take to ensure that we connect it with you or you in the purchasing of it? And then also not just in terms of the law enforcement and potential fishing expeditions, but also the commercial use of this by the retail businesses. There appear to be no protections in terms of how this data might be used for commercial third-party information. So those safeguards are not there in this, and we're very troubled by that.
Let me ask you a question. We've mm-hmm. had some discussion, again, you know, we've had fast-breaking developments in the meth manufacturing front since we did the draft. If the policy became by prescription only, and it was just put into the regular prescription process, in the pharmacies, all the forms of pseudoephedrine, would that alleviate your concerns?
Chair Burdick, that would take away our concerns, absolutely, okay. Because it would not be collective, some other form of databasing that's required by this through the Board of Pharmacy.
Thank you for clearing that.
Then I just want to alert to another area that's recently come to my attention on Senate Bill 907, and I'm looking at page 6. There's a change in this law. This has to do with the permitting, if there is a child abuse investigation going on. On page 6, it talks about the health care provider may permit the law enforcement agencies of the department to inspect or copy protected health information of the child without their consent. And that's pretty much current law there's some reworking of that section, but there's a new section following that, and it says the health care provider shall permit the law enforcement agency or the department to inspect and copy protected health information of the child involved in the investigation of child abuse without the consent of the child or the parent or guardian if the abuse being investigated consists of the child having been present in or upon the premises where methamphetamine was being manufactured or used. I raise a few concerns. I'm not an expert, and I would urge you to seek advice from those who know HIPAA regulations, but my understanding of that is while there is an exception in HIPAA for child abuse investigations to get those records without anyone's consent in the family, it's limited to the records, medical records about that would show the child the abuse, not the other information about what could be a young adult, because when a child is going to be anyone under 18. So you could be talking about a 16-year-old without their consent, all their medical records being obtained. And this needs narrowing language. It seems to be, as I said, I believe it may be inconsistent with federal law, but it's certainly a policy that troubles us, regardless of that, that there should be more restrictions on that, because that's very personal information of a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, or of anyone who normally would have the ability to consent to release of their records, but is being precluded in this case.
So, but you know, you say it's limited to abuse, and I can understand that. But if it were, if it were made clear it was limited to abuse or exposure to methamphetamine, because we consider that a form of abuse, and that's the purpose of that section, you'd be comfortable with that?
Chair Burdick, we'd certainly be more comfortable that at least it would align itself with HIPAA. I mean, I'm always troubled when we're talking about young adults. I mean, we're not talking about a 3-year-old who probably normally couldn't even give consent to their medical records to begin with. I'm always really troubled, my organization, by a 16-year-old's not even allowed to give consent. And
correct.
The other thing, I don't know what's in here, and I'm foraying into an area that I don't know much, but is there any notice given to that young adult that their records have been sought, their medical records, because they should have the right to know what the state and the authorities of the state have obtained on.
Mr. Chair.
Andrea, can you write us up a little piece and get it to Heidi so we could take a look Monday?
Sure.
On that.
Chairs, and I think there's other folks who've been far more involved in this discussion than I, as I understand I'm late to this, and so hopefully I can try to consult with them and bring you something back Monday, early next week.
Yeah, especially the access to the medical records, because that we need to be correct on that.
Right, I'm not the legal expert on HIPAA. I know there are others probably in the building who are, and if nothing else, in legislative council probably could advise. I don't want to be the authority on that. You don't want me to be the authority on it. Those are our two concerns that I particularly from the ACLU's perspective that are sort of standalone issues that we always have concerns about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, if I could just let the committee know, I did, when we sent down that particular, the medical records piece in particular, I know Virginia Vanderbilt of Legislative Council also had Holly Robinson, who is the Legislative Council expert on HIPAA, and Gwen Dayton also reviewed the draft to make sure that HIPAA was being complied with. So.
Well, but I think Ms. Myers raises a legitimate point that we don't mean to give access to all the medical records for these young people. It's the medical records pertaining to methamphetamine and abuse is what we're looking at, because I would have concerns as well with just opening the door to all the medical records.
Madam Chair, it gets a little tough, though, if you're looking for what's the damage done by medical abuse. I agree, though, we don't care about a lot of other things we shouldn't be interested in.
Right.
That could be in there.
Thank you. Other questions, comments?
Chairs, in terms of the, notifying the quote, child, if it's, at a certain age, I don't know how to write that, but is the committee interested in some requirement that if their medical records are being examined by the state, that they at least receive notice of that happening?
Right, and that's another good point as well. Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you very much. Representative Ward.
Thanks. I'm just wondering, in your opinion, we've got down here these medical records are able to be obtained by law enforcement for whenever a child's been present in a location where methamphetamine was being manufactured or used. What's the difference in terms of, how where it's manufactured, I can understand the cooks and the labs and everything, but used, I mean, what's the potential? I mean, a child, a young adult in a home where a parent or a brother or sister was using methamphetamine but never knew about it, would that still, the records of that child still be? I mean, would they have to, what kind of abuse would that show?
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, Representative Wirth, you raise good questions, and unfortunately, I am not at a level where an expert on this to be able to probably give you an adequate answer. Yes, I think there would be some concerns about how broadly this is worded, and is there a way for this committee to make it a little bit higher standard before the potential of medical records could be examined, inspected, and copied. We would certainly urge the most narrow fitting of these types of powers to ensure the balancing of both the individuals and, the government state interest in protection.
I'm glad you drew our attention to this. There are a lot of things in this bill, and this one clearly needs a more thorough review, and we'll get the right people involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Vashi and Patty Whitney. I may have murdered those names, but we'll see who comes up.
Pardon? It's Vashe, but you did pretty good.
Oh, thank you.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I am here as the...
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sarah Vashe. I live in Corvallis. I'm an asthmatic. I'm an allergy sufferer. And I am very strongly opposed to any outright ban on tablet pseudoephedrine or single-form pseudoephedrine. I cannot use phenylephrine, primarily because I like to remain a productive citizen. I work for a very kind, gracious member of this committee, and I'm sure he'd be very understanding if I called in every day for a week and said, I can't come in because they banned pseudoephedrine and I had to take phenylephrine and I'll be asleep all day because it puts me to sleep in about 30 minutes. Additionally, as an asthmatic who uses pseudoephedrine in conjunction with prescription allergy medication to help control my sinus problems, because I get sinus infections, I can tell you a respiratory tract infection can become a serious life or death situation for an asthmatic. And I'm one of those individuals who's probably the 1 in 10 who would need pseudoephedrine. I'm going to be a student next year going to law school, and to make pseudoephedrine a prescription only, which I'm willing to consider because meth is such a huge problem, you're asking me to budget $200 to $300 out of my budget next year so I can go to the doctor to get a prescription for medication that is currently over the counter. And I don't think it's fair to punish me for the crimes of a few hundred people who make and use meth in this state when there are millions of us who live here and who use these products correctly. And that's all I've got to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mike. Now, are you the illustrious sister of Lee Vashe?
Well, I don't have the pleasure of being his sister. I am his wife.
Oh, you are. Very good to meet you. Well, you're my constituent.
Yes, I am.
Good.
Thank you. Okay. Sybil Head.
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Tina Kotek. I'm the policy director with Children First for Oregon. Children First is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to impact statewide public policy to improve the lives of our kids in the state. And thank you for the opportunity to just make a few comments on 2485. First of all, I want to thank you, both the committees as well as the meth task force, for taking on a very important issue in the state. Clearly, we know that our abuse and neglect numbers for our kids are on the rise. There's a huge stress on the system, driven in many cases by what's going on with meth. So thank you. A little bit about myself. Before I came to Children First, I was a policy advocate at Oregon Food Bank. And so when I was reviewing the package of different items in 2045, the food stamp ones jumped out at me. So I had more of a question than anything else. I was trying to figure out, looking online, of all the things in the bill, the food stamp benefit one seems that it would be logistically hard to implement. I was thinking about county level probation officers trying to interact with the state, and as far as I know, there are federal laws in place that if you are misusing your food stamp card, it's fraud and can be dealt with another way. So I guess my question to the committee and to the task force is the evidence behind, would this be an effective way to deal with it? And I just haven't been able to find that information, so I was just curious if that's available online, or because it was just the one thing that didn't seem to make any sense for me, because, you know, if it's a mother, those kids need to eat. And I know there's trafficking in cars, that does happen. I just don't understand at what level it is, and if the remedy seems more complicated than maybe this, the extent of the problem. So I was just more questioning than anything else. So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Sybil Head for the Oregon Law Center, for the record. And as you know, the Oregon Law Center is a statewide nonprofit entity that provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. And the reason I'm here today is to offer our support of the bill and our thanks, because our clients, like other Oregonians, hold as one of their highest values the ability to live in and raise their families in safe communities free of violence and of drug abuse. So we appreciate the time and effort that the work group and the members of the committee have spent in taking a look at this difficult issue. I wanted to present just a few brief comments. As a former family law practitioner, I had some thoughts about the section 6 of the bill on page 13, which addresses the ability of the courts to suspend or terminate parenting time when there has been an allegation or use of controlled substances. And my concern about that provision is that it may cause confusion and unintentionally detract from the court's ability to address these circumstances in domestic relations cases. And I just wanted to point out for the record that the court already has the authority to modify, alter, set aside provisions related to parenting time in domestic relations cases. And we see in our experience that the court does this not routinely, but as appropriate when the facts demand. And certainly we have seen that drug abuse, and particularly meth abuse, has been the type of circumstance that would prompt a judge to make that sort of decision or determination. And the reason that the bill, this provision of the bill, causes me some concern is that it is carving out a specific exception, basically a specific provision that relates to the judge's ability to terminate or suspend parenting time in these circumstances. And I wouldn't want this to be interpreted so as to limit the judge's ability to do that in other circumstances that may not involve controlled substances but may give rise to the same concerns about the safety of the children. And so I would echo Nancy Miller's suggestion that there be some language inserted that makes it clear that this provision is not intended to alter or minimize the court's abilities in other respects. I think the other concern that I have is that the bill speaks to the court's ability to terminate or suspend, but it doesn't address the court, or doesn't suggest that there may be other methods that would be appropriate modifications to a parenting time plan when there's been abuse of a controlled substance. And we heard testimony last night, and I don't believe today yet, but we have heard testimony about the importance during recovery for both children and for parents of having some contact, and that may in some circumstances be appropriate and very beneficial for children. And I wouldn't want this provision to be interpreted so as to discourage the provision of supervised visitation, for example, or other methods. So those are my only comments on that particular provision. I would also just echo and support the concerns that Ms. Meyer raised with respect to the provisions of health records without consent, and appreciate your willingness to take a look at that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Representative Boone is in the audience. Would you like to say a few words? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Boone. I represent House District 32, the Upper Left Coast. I just want to thank you for what you've done here. I'm very impressed with the package. I'd like to just speak briefly to, I think it's 907, and thank you for including some of the language in a bill I introduced early on into, I think it's part of this one, it's part of some other ones, but what you're doing is the right thing. I'm putting out my column for the second half of session today and outline a couple of these bills, and I just wanted to thank you for it. I think you're going the right direction. We got to do what we can to help this problem, so thank you.
Thank you for your support. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Do you remember which provision that was that was in your bill?
It's about a child being in a house where there's meth being made or stored, or and then it has to do with parental rights connected with that. So
appreciate that.
A young woman from my district actually brought this to my attention, and she was very excited to get the call from your staff. She knew that it wasn't going to be her bill. I said, you've got to let go of that part of it. You just have to be happy it's there. So,
thank you. Thank you very much.
It's Oregon's bill.
It's Oregon's bill, yes.
Okay, your turn.
Where are we at? You did these two.
Yeah.
Angela Martin and Ellen, is it Lowe?
Chair Burdick, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to present testimony to you today. For the record, Angela Martin, I'm here representing Oregon Food Bank, here representing our opposition to Section 23 of House Bill 2485 related to denying food stamp benefits to certain convicted drug felons. Before I outline our concerns with this provision, I want to take a moment to highlight some important facts about the food stamp program. Oregon Food Bank has been a partner in statewide efforts to increase participation in the nation's second most important anti-poverty program. I made mention to some of my colleagues earlier today, legislators today actually have debated the two most important anti-poverty programs in this nation. We started off this morning with a conversation about the Earned Income Tax Credit, and now we're having a conversation about the food stamp program. Again, the two most important programs for alleviating poverty in this country. As a result of the work of so many anti-hunger advocates throughout the state and in coordination with the Department of Human Services, Oregon now ranks at the top of states for food stamp participation. What this means in practical terms is that more eligible families in Oregon are receiving assistance they need to put nutritious food on their table. I brought figures for April of 2005. In that month, over 430,000 Oregonians, those are seniors, children's, family, people who work, people who are disabled, 430,000 Oregonians received food stamp benefits. These benefits are 100% federally funded. As a result, $38 million federal dollars were invested in Oregon's economy, supporting business owners, creating jobs, and feeding families. In 2004, the total federal investment was over $400 million in Oregon, dedicated to supporting local grocery stores, expanding the spending power of participating households, and fortifying family health. And it's these statistics that really help highlight why the food stamp program is the nation's second most important anti-poverty program. In 1996, Congress passed the Welfare Reform Bill, which included a provision creating a lifetime ban on food stamp program benefits for anyone, individual, convicted of a drug felony. States at that point were granted the right to opt out of the ban. Oregon was one of the leaders among states selecting to opt out. We are now one of 12 states, plus the District of Columbia, that fully opt out of the federal drug felony disqualification. And just last year, Washington legislators voted to join the growing number of states opting to provide access to federal nutrition programs for all financially eligible households. Before you, you have a copy of a report from the Washington State, Free Today, Hungry Tomorrow. This provides you an overview of the barriers former drug felons face when they're trying to obtain a healthy diet, support themselves and their families as they move from addiction to recovery. As the legislators in Washington discovered, and as leaders in Oregon have long known, food stamp benefits are an important part of this equation of moving from addiction to recovery. There's no denying the very real problem that we're facing in our communities as a result of increasing addiction to methamphetamine. This year alone, our partners throughout the food bank network have asked us to present them information on the increasing use of meth and the impact that it's having on anti-hunger relief agencies. So we're having that conversation, and we're feeling the impact as well. However, we're unified in our agreement that denying access to nutrition assistance will not help us solve this problem. As our friends in Washington discovered, and as you will hear two women testify this evening, people with addiction need access to opportunities, including nutrition assistance that they are financially eligible to receive. Food stamp disqualification harms these families, harms our communities at the very moment when they are needed most to help provide a supporting environment to aid in the recovery. Food stamp disqualification proposal that's before you in Section 23 of House Bill 2485 would also increase Oregon's risk for federal penalties. The federal government evaluates state implementation of the food stamp program through quality control. We actually monitor the state's error rate. I think you heard testimony earlier this afternoon from Sue Abrams talking about the concerns that were raised and the complications and conflicts that this language would create for DHS. In recent past, Oregon was subject to penalties due to our high error rate in our food stamp program. This proposal would require DHS to track and monitor additional information about program participants, creating increased opportunities and for error, increased opportunities for fiscal penalties from the federal government. I'll end again by saying thank you for the opportunity to testify and asking the members of this committee to remove the food stamp provision from the legislation being considered, simply because at the most basic level, denying food to any individual, regardless of their past offenses, is unjust. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think anybody here wants to not deny food to anybody that's hungry, but let me just read what it says here. It makes it, they may suspend a person's food stamps if they've been convicted and the person's on probation or post-supervision, blah, 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 and the agency supervising the person makes a recommendation to the department to suspend those benefits, and their recommendation has to be based on a few things here, whether that person traded the food stamps for controlled substances and that as a result a member of the person's household did not receive the food stamp benefits for which the member is eligible. It seems like they are denying themselves food at this point. We are not denying them food, and I think it's a pretty good balance, really, when it comes down to it. It's not automatic. There's discretion, and I'm just wondering what I don't see it as a denial of food to people who are truly using it.
Representative Thatcher, Chair. Two concerns I want to highlight with that. First, there is a federal provisions, and we'll hear more about that when we hear a testimony from Ellen Lowe, federal and state provisions that already make it illegal. There are penalties, both monetary penalties and criminal penalties, for people who engage in fraudulent activities with their food stamps. Those are in place. The concern that this language creates is the reason to believe aspect of it. You heard Sue Abrams talk about the right to a hearing. These are some of the concerns that we have with this language, that the reason to believe is a lot different than you've been found guilty of fraud. We have protections in place at both the state and the federal level to prevent people who are selling their food stamps for drugs or other reasons, prevent them from gaining benefits from the program. We feel that those safeguards are sufficient to stop that type of fraudulent activity.
You were expecting me to ask another question, weren't you?
I'm hoping not.
I can leave it at that, if you really.
Go ahead, please. co-chairs Burdick and Krieger, and I am Ellen Lowe. I serve as a legislative advocate both for the Oregon Food Bank and for the Oregon Law Center, and I do need to acknowledge how grateful I am for the fact that this is a joint committee, and I hope that this means that there will be other joint committees beginning to function again in this building. There are several things that I'd like to highlight. I did have distributed to you the federal and the state regulations, and I think you can see that they really do provide the opportunity for sanctions. The other is that the Department of Human Services has just about 10 days ago, I believe, opened a fraud line so that they do have a phone that is dedicated to receiving information about possible fraud involved in public assistance. There has also long been one of those lines for the in the Secretary of State's office. But I'd like to comment about a question that Chair Krieger had for Sue Abrams from the department, and that's when you were asking about the numbers. And one of the responses was that when there's co-location of some of the state and county functions, and that's more often in a rural area than in urban areas, there is good communication. And so when you ask about what can be done and perhaps what should be done, may I follow up on Sue Abrams' suggestion that there be that this be done by administrative rule, but that there really needs to be within all the state and county and sometimes other local functions operating in responding to this problem some better communication, because we have heard from some women who have become part of the judicial system as a result of their meth use that there was nothing said to them about some of the treatment options, about some of the things that were available. And so if anything, as I have followed the work of the task force, and I was here last night listening, the need for better communications among all of the folks who are involved, and so that evidently there were some within the correction system who were operating under the assumption that there were not sanctions for the fraudulent use of that card, the Oregon Trail card, and there are. And so it would appear as if maybe there isn't need. We would suggest there isn't need for the inclusion of this within the report. It was also last night where the chair of the task force talked about the differences between Oregon and Washington, and then Judge Larson mentioned what is validated by the report that you received today, that Washington indeed does allow the continued availability of food stamps, and I'm not sure what they call their card in Washington, to those who have been convicted. On behalf of the organizations I represent, I want to echo what you've heard a lot about today, and that's the importance of drug courts and the savings that really accrue to the system, but more than that, to society as a result of the use of drug courts. But one of the things that Judge Larson mentioned was the importance of community and family supports for the folks who are part of the drug court system. And so family includes the children, often, of those who have been meth users. And so those kinds of things that we can do in the area of housing and nutrition and social supports to allow them to really be successful in recovery. But the other, I hope you noted that Oregon is 49th in terms of providing treatment. And so when I mentioned that I hope another joint committee begins to function, I was thinking of a place where you were in hearing room F last night. I spend four mornings a week, or I used to, in front of a joint committee in that room, and now I can go there twice a day, actually, with the separate budget committees. But the chemical treatment, the mental health treatment, those particular services in Oregon are desperately in need of additional funding so that folks who do come under the influence of meth and they are ready, that there is treatment when they're ready. And it doesn't do much good when they have to have a long wait. The other is to expand, actually it isn't expand, it's to sort of go back to where we were in terms of Oregon Health Plan standard and expand its availability to a wider population. Because now to be on TANF, you have to be 48% of the federal poverty level. And there was a time when we were making that available up to 100% of the federal poverty level for adults. And it included mental health and chemical dependency treatment. And that is another place. So both expanding the community-based mental health and chemical dependency treatment, and then also trying to re-energize the Oregon Health Plan so the drug courts indeed can work. Because Judge Larson was pretty clear that it really involved all of that. And so it isn't just the court itself. Again, our thank you for coming together on this. We really feel the concerns that have been expressed by Representative Thatcher and Representative Flores regarding the food stamps really are already, those remedies are already available. What we need is that internal communication. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not to belabor the point, but for clarification, the Washington report that you distributed, and I appreciate, is dated February 2003. Now, it was perhaps, as I understood, was it Judge Larson last night that made reference to the Washington action that was relatively current in making some restrictive use of the card in Washington. So this might be prior to the action that was implemented.
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, the more restrictive action in Washington was before their recent action. What they have decided to do is that it was costly in terms of people and society and government to deny those services, that they wanted to aid recovery rather than place barriers for recovery. And so Washington now does allow for convicted drug felons to have access to nutritional assistance. And so the assumption that Chair Myers was operating on was incomplete. Judge Larson corrected that. And so Washington is now like Oregon.
Thank you. I wanted to reiterate your concerns about the food stamp section. And
as I understand it, I mean, I think we need to get a grip on what we're talking about. As I understand it, we have approximately 11% of the population in the state of Oregon receiving food stamps, and almost 70% of the aid to dependent or families of dependent children recipients are children, and 92% of the families on welfare are single mothers. So we're talking about a disproportionately small portion of the overall population. It's only 11%. Now, we're talking about, what, $70 a month per person, about 90 cents a meal. So, I mean, let's say that this is a serious problem that this bill goes to towards alleviating. How big of an impact are we talking about when we're talking about $70 a month, 11% of the population, 90 cents a meal? And if these people don't have food stamps, wouldn't they be likely to go out and steal the food or get it somehow?
Chair Krieger, Representative Worth, I'll start by saying the impact on the family. Every year I get to go out and have conversations with individuals who receive emergency food boxes, people who utilize food stamps. And in one of those conversations, we were talking about an item that cost $10. And this person looked at me and said, well, it just might as well cost $200, because for me, $10 is as far away from a reality as $200 is. So the $70 that a person will get in food stamps, and I think that average actually now is more around $80 per individual. It has gone up just a little bit. But that $70 or $80 per individual will spell the difference between adequate nutrition and not. The impact for a local community as well is quite great. I have statistics available on how much money goes to each local community through these food stamp dollars. So it's a significant impact, which I think is what you were...
Can I make a clarification? Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm saying is, it seems like this bill is overemphasizing the impact that this, by denying food stamp benefits, to be having. I mean, we're talking about such a small amount of the population and such a meager amount that we give them in food stamp benefits, and again, it's all federally funded. So I think you very aptly put the impact to the individual, because we're talking about the poor who receive these benefits. So I guess I'm just saying, thinking, is the problem that big given that it's such a small amount of people who get this very small benefit?
Chair Krieger, Representative Worth, the problem has not been demonstrated as I've been able to see it. We have not seen statistics, at least they've not been pointed out to me, showing that this trading of food stamps for drugs represents a large portion of those that receive benefits. So I see what you're saying, and I think you're right. It is, unless someone would like to point out differently.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Thatcher, did you have anything further, or did you?
Well, I was just going to ask what the value of one of those food stamp cards would be about. Was that about $70 a month? Or?
On the average, Mr. Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher. And, of course, it would depend on the size of the family.
So it could be more than $100?
It could be, or it could be less. And I should also point out that food stamps, a considerable number of people who receive food stamps in Oregon are actually not on TANF, but are very low income, often single adults. Again, your food stamp eligibility is based on your income. I would just like to say that, going back to what Judge Larson said, though, where he really talked about the importance of those kinds of supports for people who are in recovery. And in this bill, in this section, we're talking about folks, it's post-conviction. These are folks who, hopefully, on their way back.
We've got to move on with this, please. If you've got further questions, address them in a letter, talk to them, call them. I'm not going to go into it, but I really believe the focal point of the bill has been missed. So thank you for your time. I've got two more people I want to get to here. Sandra Pleasant and Cindy Finch.
Yes.
State your names and tell us your story.
Chair Krieger and other members of the committee, my name is Sandra Pleasant. I am here to testify on my past uses of, I use drugs, I use methamphetamines. I had a 15-year drug addiction, which brought me to the court system, the drug courts, and then I ended up going into probation. I went into treatment. I went into many different treatments facilities before I found the right one. And as I was getting clean, I needed the services that I received. I received the food stamps. I used the welfare system. I didn't prepare anything for today, so bear with me.
That's fine.
And my phone's vibrating. Excuse me. I have a 12-year-old daughter at home. She was very young throughout all of this, and I couldn't have made it without the help of my probation officer, the treatment programs that I received. The one I finally went through was Tualatin Valley Mental Health, which is now known as LifeWorks Northwest, and it's an excellent treatment facility. I feel that I now have four years clean and sober on the 29th of this month. Let me get to that first. And I'm very proud of that. And I couldn't have done it without all of the treatment facilities that were available. Steps to Success program, which I'm in right now, doing volunteer work so that I can get a better job. Although I am finding it difficult because having the wreckage of your past is a real tough thing for you, you know. It's a very tough thing because when they see that felony show up on the application, you can't seem to get past that. I am considering now trying to find a way to go to college, and I would like to be a drug and alcohol counselor. I think that without all of the help that I received, I couldn't have made it. You know, it really gave me a good support system, and I don't know. Trying to think of everything that I wanted to say today to make sure that it's covered. So I don't know. As far as this, the food stamp thing, I know that a lot of people, when they're out there using, that they do tend to, you know, use their food stamps. And I think that it's a pretty messed up thing that they do that, you know, because it's just wrong. It's just wrong. Everything I do today, I have to do. And that's one thing, thankfully, I never did. But at the same side of it, you know, if I didn't have my food stamps, you know, I may have been out there in my addiction. But I did get my food stamps, and I did make certain that my daughter always had something to eat. I mean, like the one gentleman that was up here earlier, I just listened to him, and, you know, yeah, you get threat of your daughter or your child being taken away from you, and, you know, it kind of, if you love that child at all, which, you know, I don't know very many mothers that don't, but I know there are some out there, but you take care of them. You take care of them, and it may not have been my first priority, and it was a really hard battle for me to pull through the addiction, and it was a very poor choice I made to do that first drug the very first time, you know. But I pulled through, and I'm here, and I couldn't have done it without the programs that are available. And at the risk of repeating myself, and I hope I covered everything I came here to say, thank you very much.
Okay.
Chair Krieger, is that how you say name? Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak today. My name is Cindy Finch, and I'm a mother of six children. I've battled with meth addiction for 15 years, and
due to the fact of the poor choices that I made and the ability I gave up to maintain employment during that time, the food stamp benefits was the only reliable resource that I had to feed my children. I'm very nervous.
Don't be nervous.
I'm nervous because after all those people talking about meth, I'm the meth addict, and I'm just really, I'm nervous. So.
And we got food addicts.
I know. I now live a productive life, and I just want to tell you why, and that's because I did treatment. I just think, after hearing everybody speak today, that the only solution is to send people to treatment. I feel really strong about that, and I've been fortunate enough to see 27 different women make it now and have a productive life with their children because of treatment. And I was fortunate to go to a treatment that does take children, so I feel fortunate to have been in a treatment center like that. And I hope that eventually more of those kind of treatment centers actually get open. But anyway. I just want to stress, because the programs like food stamps and TANF, I am able to, it's provided me support and I'm able to lead a productive, I guess, a life that now I'm back on my feet, and for me and my children. And let's see what else. I think that's about it.
Do you have any questions?
Thanks for coming, both of you. I've got a question. First of all, if you were, I think you said you had traded food stamps, but you had not. So if you were accused of, or if there was a notification that they had reason to believe that you had traded your food stamp benefits for controlled substances, and as a result of the trading, that a member of your household did not receive food stamp benefits, how would you defend yourself against that? What kind of documentation do you receive? What kind of records do you keep to show that?
Okay, I just blanked out. It's been such a long day, and forgive me, but could you please repeat that, Representative Ward?
I'm asking if, what kind of documentation or records do you hold as a food stamp recipient that would prove that you were using your food stamps for food and not possibly trading them or selling them? Is there any documentation? How could you defend yourself?
That's easy. Receipts. Store receipts.
And you keep all your receipts?
Well, if I was under the, and I do not trade my food stamps either, but if I was under the, if I had a probation officer or whoever asked me if I was, that's how I would expect. And yeah, I do keep my receipts actually. Because that's your note. That's how much you have left on your card. So I do keep those. So, I also thought, I was thinking about, how you could address this issue, and what I thought or propose or whatever. If there's proof or any kind of belief that someone is trading the food stamps, there is on-site at AFS now that are drug counselors. I think that you should implement treatment, make them go to treatment. Do you see what I'm saying that pretty much?
In our discussion, as I recall, the basis of looking at the food stamps was to be one more tool in the toolbox of the probation people to keep you in that post-release program for recovery. And that's what we talked about. It's not the whole answer. I think it's going to be rarely used, but it might be the one thing. And nobody, in fact, the biggest concern that Representative McPherson had, and I had, in fact, all on the work group was, what about the families that have kids in the family? But we also got to the point that probably if they're breaking their probation and they're that bad into meth, 99% of the time they're not going to have their kids. Kids are going to be somewhere else until we can get them into recovery. And if that's a tool to get them into recovery, I think it needs to be, there may be an instance where it could be used. Not necessarily that it will be used. One of the blondes over there read all the criteria. All the criteria that goes through there before we'd ever get there. So I think there's going to be some safeguards, and we're going to look at the issue Monday based on the testimony that you've given us here today. It isn't a done deal. We're going to be looking at the merits of it, the pros and cons, and maybe limit as to under what conditions it might happen.
Chair Krieger, may I say one more thing, please?
Very briefly.
I can understand what you're saying, and I do respect what you're striving for, and I think it's a really, interesting concept. I do find that, like you said, I didn't lose my children. My children are not taken from me. gratefully and thankfully. But, you know, like you said, the ones with children's, the cons could be pretty bad. I mean, if a person doesn't have food to eat, even when you come down off the jug, you want to eat. You want to eat a lot, you know, and you need to eat. Your body is, you know, deprived of all of the vitamins that it requires. And, I mean, you're going to have some half skeletons walking around town if they don't have some food to eat. Then you're going to be looking at maybe a possibility in rising crime rate, because they're going to be going out trying to steal some food or steal money to get the food so that they can eat. You know, there's that thought to consider also. Thank you.
Mayor Thatcher, and that's going to be the last question.
Actually, it was Flores. Thank you very much. My first question is to council. Can you check the list to see if those blondes over there is on the list under the training that we had received?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Representative Flores. We love and appreciate you so much. We went put all the beauty in one part of the room.
So. There, yes. Okay. Yeah. It might begin to work somewhere, but anyway.
That one.
Ladies, I honor the fact that you're here, and thank you very much. My question is, and because you both referred to get them in treatment, when you were finally in treatment, would you have gone, if somebody had arbitrarily put you in treatment or submitted you to treatment before you were really ready to receive treatment?
I was forced to go to treatment. So I was on probation, and my probation officer actually said, Cindy, you can do treatment or incarceration. And of course, I chose treatment. I'm grateful for that. So that's why I was wondering if you're going to... That's where the probation already has that power, so why did... Do you need to give them that power to take away the food stamps? Do you see what I'm saying? They already have...
Outside the food stamp question, as far as entering treatment, because I think that's a very important component. But can someone receive treatment before they're ready mentally to receive it?
Yes, absolutely. You can go. I went to treatment first. Actually, I went to treatment before the probation officer said if you leave, then I get incarcerated. So actually, that's how it worked for me. But anybody can go and get treatment. And I actually work with women and encourage other addicts that out there are still suffering to go to treatment. There is long waiting lists, however. There's not enough centers.
Representative Flores and Chair Krieger, I would like to also say to what she's, you know, the answer to your question. You know, I was a 15-year IV drug user, okay? I would sit, and as I was doing a hit after hit after hit, would be crying, wishing that somebody would come and help me, take me out of this disease and help me. Help me to live. Help me to just get away from it. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And I call the criminal justice system divine intervention, because I'm lucky to be alive today, and I am so thankful, so very thankful, for the treatment centers that are available. And I really believe that Washington County needs to get some more money together and get more treatment centers in Washington County and make it more accessible for people who have been in my shoes and for hers as well. Treatment centers, put your money there. Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Was there anyone else in the audience that hadn't got justify that wanted to? Okay, thank you for staying with us, committee members. The information we have received, there's some written information we're going to get. The work group will be getting together 1 o'clock Monday to incorporate these ideas and see which ones have the value, and then get those amendments into the bill and then bring them to both the full House and the full Senate. Will hear theirs, and we'll move forward. Thank you. We're adjourned.